On the right down here?
Was thinking.
They're intense.
They're very intense.
Be in the Greek Isles or someplace.
Oh, you're live.
Ready on the left? All right. Good afternoon. I'd like to call to order the May 24th, 2010 session of the House Subcommittee on Workforce Development, and welcome all of our guests and our audience this afternoon. We have a fairly lengthy informational meeting today, and Teresa, if you would please give us some brief background about what we're going to be hearing and perhaps why this afternoon.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. As you can see, committee members, there are three main topics on today's agenda. We are kicking off our hearing with an update from the Healthcare Workforce Committee, which is part of the Oregon Health Policy Board that was formed under House Bill 2009. So you're going to get an update from both committee members and staff on what's going on with the committee currently and future initiatives. The second item is actually Representative Denbrough is going to come and talk to us about what's going on with the Career and Technical Education Collaboration Task Force, and that was also a result of legislation that actually the subcommittee and the full committee worked on in the 2009 session. And then last but certainly not least, we are going to look at a number of great examples of collaborations between community colleges and businesses throughout Oregon in regards to job training. There's some excellent examples in all parts of the state on that, so we're just going to highlight a few examples of that.
All right, and we'll open the informational meeting. And first, as Teresa said, we're going to be talking about the Oregon Health Policy Board. And I'd like to welcome this afternoon Dean Ann Maloche, and if I have mispronounced that, my apologies, and Sean Colmer. And I don't know if you have anyone else that's going to be accompanying you. Welcome. Good afternoon, and thank you for your willingness to share your information with our subcommittee.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Colmer, Deputy Administrator of the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research in the Oregon Health Authority. I wanted to first thank you for the opportunity for us to share with you a little bit about the progress of the Healthcare Workforce Committee of the Oregon Health Policy Board, and I will let Ann do but more justice than I could do for that work in just a minute. I also want to say that John Moorhead, who is the chair of this committee, wishes he could have been here today, but he's actually seeing patients in the emergency department right now. So I think it's appropriate that he's doing that instead of this today. For a little background information, this committee has been meeting monthly since about February. It is a 24-member committee of very diverse backgrounds from the educational field, from employers, from professionals, experts, and one of those experts who is actually lead staff on this work with the Office of Health Policy is Joe Isgrig in the Healthcare Workforce Institute. So we feel like it's a really valuable asset that we have in moving this work forward to sort of learn on what we've been doing and sort of partner together to sort of make this work go better. So with that, I will let Ann talk about what the committee's been up to and answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon, Representative Chair Witt and representatives. I appreciate the time here. Again, my name is Ann Maloche. I'm Dean of Business, Healthcare, and Workforce at Lynn Benton Community College and am Vice Chair and just truly pinch-hitting for John, who's doing his day job. Anyway, as Sean mentioned, the committee is represented by 24 individuals from all across Oregon. And so first up, one of the most important aspects of this committee and what we've not done before is truly bring practitioners and educators and representatives from nonprofits and AHECs together to have a statewide conversation. We've all done a lot of good work in our silos, but we've not, again, come together. So this is one of the strengths of the committee. The committee is staffed by representatives from the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research and the Oregon Healthcare Institute, which Sean mentioned that Joe Isrig is a part of. And they're truly doing a lot of the work for the committee so the committee can focus on data that that group has collected. And in the letter, informational letter that you received, you've noticed that an inventory and a database has been started by these groups to help us then make more informed decisions. So simply put, the goal of the committee is truly one of making connections, a convener. As I mentioned, Oregon has got many examples of exemplar programs and practices. Unfortunately, they tend just to stay in their area, and they're never brought to scale. So this committee is going to, with all of the diverse members, is going to have, we'll have conversations regarding how can we take best practices and move them forward. Another goal of the committee and work of the committee is one to look at different legislation, different policies and practices that might stand in the way of getting people to work in the healthcare field. And so with information that we gathered from the staff that works with us in conversations, we're hoping to make recommendations to the Health Policy Board in making changes that would allow folks to go to work quicker and more efficiently. So what the committee's been up to so far, as Sean mentioned, we just began in February. So this is very truly a very general and brief update. We have spent time getting to know one another, getting to know what areas that we're championing, what areas that we have issues and barriers with. And in this week's meeting, actually we meet next in May, we will be looking at our strategic plan and prioritizing some of the first steps or short-term areas that we'll focus on is in program delivery. As you've all heard, we have issues with healthcare workers in rural Oregon. So we're really trying to embrace more of the grow-your-own mentality. And in doing this, we need to bring programs to the rural Oregon. It's not cost-effective to have each different area start their own program, so distance education and technology is key there. So this group is really going to look at the barriers that stand in the way of bringing those programs to rural Oregon and for those who want them, which means there's technology infrastructure, there's financial aid barriers, there's student services barriers, all of those things that we need to look at when we try to bring education to the student as opposed to having the student come to the educational facility. And then there's also trying to work together and collaborate on new program development. Healthcare programs are expensive, and it doesn't make sense when you have communities that just may need one or two graduates to have programs that have 24 graduates. So trying to have a collaborated effort with new program development with organizations from K-12 to universities will allow us to be more strategic, to be able to provide a labor market that isn't too many or too few, but just right on. And lastly, really taking a look at labor market projections and trying to help different educational institutions decide on the numbers that they should bring in and admit every year. For instance, in the Lynn Benton Community College area, I'll have nurses graduating in June, and the majority of them will not have jobs. This is unique. This hasn't happened in a long time. The students, quite honestly, are scared. Looking at the labor market projections and looking at the Oregon Employment Department's data that was provided to this committee a couple months ago shows us that in 3 years that won't be the case anymore. So, again, this committee, in looking at the data, will help recommend, you know, that we should stay the course, we should keep our admissions the way they are, that there will be jobs there soon, and help educate students in what their options are right now. So those are some very short-term or immediate goals of the committee. We're hoping to provide you with a lengthy, prioritized strategic plan sometime in midsummer when this committee is somewhat underway. So that is a very brief update on the committee's work. We're new. We're excited. Again, this is the first opportunity for these conversations to go across the state, and we're looking forward to do good work. We'd be happy to answer questions from any of you.
Thank you very, very much.
And Chair Witt, if I may, I just give you a reference to the documents you have in front of you. The first is obviously the letter that the Chair and Ann produced for you. And then there are a couple of documents, the first two being the charter of the Workforce Committee and the roster, so you can really get a sense of not only the geographic diversity, but also sort of what sectors are they coming from. Also, our initial analysis of the workforce opportunities in the federal reform law just recently passed. And then lastly is a really tremendous document about an emerging workforce around HIT that the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute produced. So if and when you have time, I really recommend you take a look at that as well.
Thank you very, very much.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Greenlick.
Can I ask a couple questions?
Please do.
Thank you. It's my impression that we're never going to serve the needs of the emerging healthcare system with the nature of the health force we have now. Is there any chance that you're going to be doing something that will be sort of revolutionary rather than let's see if we can get a few more PTs out into Eastern Oregon?
Could you explain a little bit what you mean by not able to, or our current system not working for our future need?
I think over the last 40 years, we've created narrower and narrower classifications of personnel, that we have these huge silos. We had that experience in the healthcare committee dealing with imaging, where you have radiological techs, you have MRI techs, you have sonographers, you have... Mm-hmm. It seems to be completely crazy. I mean, you know, I aggravate both the PTs and the OTs by suggesting that it's actually one profession we've divided into two. It seems to me we need new kinds of healthcare workforce for 10 and 20 years from now that are much more generalized, that have much more cross-training, that have much more cross-licensing, if you will, or more generic kind of licensing. Is there anything you folks are doing that'll point us in the direction of changing the kind of distribution or the nature of healthcare workers we have now?
Our accrediting boards do have very rigorous standards, but one of the agenda items on our work plan truly is to make recommendations for the areas that you are talking about so we can have a little bit more interdisciplinary work, a little bit more play across fields. So we, again, our committee's role is to recommend, and we do plan on doing that.
May I continue?
Please.
Why just a little? I mean, we talk about having people working at the top of their license. Why not having people working at the bottom of the next group's license? I mean, why? I mean, is there anybody around this state looking at completely changing the nature of the healthcare workforce? And is that something you all feel maybe isn't in your first week's job, but somewhere down the line, something that you'll be focusing on?
It's a good conversation to have, and I promise you we will bring it to the committee's attention.
And Chair Witt, Representative Greenlick, I think what you're referring to as well is sort of the interdependencies between the delivery system reform work that is happening in another committee and sort of this workforce committee having an eye for what they're thinking about and how to reorganize the system. For example, primary care health homes. What does that look like, and what kind of workforce do you need? And then having this group really make recommendations on, well, how do we feed that kind of workforce into that sort of payment system or delivery system change? So I think it's on their list, and they're waiting for other groups as well. So, yeah.
Mr. Chair, there's a big literature in the 70s on the workforce for the 20th. You know, for the 21st century. It's the sort of thing that got us PAs and nurse practitioners and a variety of other kinds of different personnel. And I don't sense that this is going on anywhere. I mean, I sense the opposite is happening. This is a counter-revolution where how we can get more and more narrow in our definition of who can do the things we think we ought to do. It would be. And I'd be happy to talk to the task force as well. But, I mean, I think we really need some more dramatic thinking. It would be great if that could be the place this happened.
And Representative Greenlick, I would add that you started me thinking about the challenges that silos bring, particularly to rural Oregon and districts such as my own that are significantly challenged to be able to have practitioners. And the barriers that silos add to that whole process. So
these are brick silos.
These are bricks. So no matter how hard you huff and puff,
I tried huffing and puffing; it hasn't helped much.
Thank you, Representative Greenlick. Representative Dembrough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just to follow up on the line that Representative Greenlick has opened. You know, one of the reasons that we established this committee was to, you know, work to to look at the strategic goals of the health authority and the the health policy board, and to find ways to implement those strategic goals through transformation of the workforce. Certainly having the adequate numbers, but also be thinking about
much more eloquently than I.
So it is more a than just a question of numbers. It's also a question, I think, of visioning, what we want the health delivery system to look like in 10, 15, 20 years, whatever. And I'm just thinking of my my own aunt who is getting care at home, and she's getting good care, but she has a different person coming in to do basic medical care, another person for physical therapy, another person for occupational therapy, and it's so duplicative that it's hard to see how we can really sustain that as a system. Whereas it might well be possible, to have a single individual who could be a kind of healthcare case manager for her, who could be helping her with a variety of things. And, it seems like we ought to be pressing for that kind of, that kind of position, both from the health education providers, and also the licensing boards. And I'm just wondering if you see, and Sean, you kind of touched on this, that, how do you see this working into the work plan of the committee as to when, this kind of workforce visioning or revisioning will happen?
Go first. Chair Witt, Representative Denbrough, I think that's sort of the stage two of this committee's work, is what's the long-term strategic vision for workforce in this state in a delivery system that looks like what? I think that is really what this group is really the long-term charge is, and figuring out, again, those interdependencies on other groups, not only delivery system changes, but the changes in health information technology, new emerging fields that we haven't really even thought about, and how do those all sort of work together in a strategic vision, and not, as Anne was eloquently saying earlier, they were happening but all over the place. And now this hopefully is the place to have that conversation and make sure that we're being strategic in how we're doing things.
And Chair Witt, Representative Denbrough, to add on that, this committee will bring, the conversation has to happen with the licensing boards, with the accrediting bodies. This committee is set up to be able to make that happen. It has all the right people on. So we're hopeful.
Good. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the conversation and don't discount the importance of this long-term thinking and, what we're going to do in the second stage or the second week, as Representative Greenlick mentioned. But I'm kind of curious what we're doing in the first week in regards to one of the things that was mentioned was the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. And the workforce development funding opportunities. I worry that we will spend so much time, looking at our long-range strategies and goals that we will let slip an opportunity to bring funding to Oregon. It seems like to me that would be a major priority that should be addressed today so that we can access some of those dollars that will be out there. Otherwise, we'll still be talking about it, and the dollars will have evaporated to somebody else in some other state. Mm-hmm. And so I hope that there's some focus about, of how we're going to access these dollars, regardless of what program it goes into. I guess my notion is if we sit down there and can't figure out exactly what we want to do, and then you do nothing in regards to these dollars. So I would implore you to think about taking action on getting some dollars into the system. And let's, at least we'll have some immediate return in a time when we really need it most of getting some opportunities for workforce training. So I hope that's really high on your priority list. I didn't really see it high in your priority list. It seemed to be down in the weeds where you're just talking about identifying opportunities. And it seems to me that we should be, moving that up and saying we need to take action and get these dollars to Oregon, ASAP, because somebody else is going after them right now, too.
Chair Witt and Representative Holvey, we had this lengthy conversation in our last meeting regarding low-hanging fruit and truly getting ourselves ready for funding that would come in. And so we are, part of our meeting agenda is to organize ourselves to be able to just attack the new dollars that are coming through, wherever those may be. So that is, and it might not be reflected here, but truly it is one of our top priorities. We'll be ready.
Good to hear.
And following up on Representative Holvey's question and your answer, and I know there's undoubtedly a plethora of potential grants, but is there a somewhat universal window of time to be applying for this money, and are these timelines that you're aware of, and perhaps our subcommittee should be aware of as well?
Chair Witt, we typically get about 6 weeks window when we learn that money is coming down, and we have tried to align ourselves with partners and with work planned and with the numbers to be ready to go after any of those grants. So the ones that I'm familiar with, we have a structure in place and the connections that we're ready to go after those. We don't know until they give us the criteria for the grant what exactly the focus should be, and it does change with every grant opportunity.
Certainly. I would just like you to be aware, too, that if there is a role for this subcommittee to be supportive when you make those applications, to please let us know. Additional questions or comments from the subcommittee? I had just a couple here, I think. And I know it's virtually impossible to be able to target the number of folks that you would be letting into the pipeline so that there aren't too many and aren't not too few, but just right. Because there is probably no specific target, but how do you best approach that in making the determination of how many to bring into the pipeline?
We, speaking for the community colleges, we really have close ties with the Oregon Employment Department, who helps us with projections, helps us with the prioritization, and we look to them to help us with our crystal ball. We also do informal surveys with employers to understand that their needs in the next 5 years. What we are doing now is we're not reducing numbers. We've all decided we're at least staying the course, and because we realize that students that we bring in now, it's about 3 years from now is when they'll actually be looking for jobs. So we just try to look out about every 5 years and make some good guesses.
And to what extent are you involved with the Oregon Workforce Investment Board in perhaps setting this range of goals, as well as other work that your committee is involved in?
So I am part of the Workforce Strategies group from CCWD, which, again, we have connections and meetings with OWIB, and I'm on my local Workforce Investment Board, Region 4, and so we have those conversations at that level also.
And Chair Witt, OE and Joe Isgrig are liaisons to that group as well, so we're sort of directly connected to them as well.
Great. And without trying to put you on the spot, is there a message at this point, and we understand fully well that your board has a lot of work in front of it, but is there anything at this point that you would like this subcommittee to be aware of or anticipating in the future, or something that we should keep in mind in terms of being able to lend support to the work that you're going to be undertaking?
Chair Witt, truly we're looking at, in some aspects, systems change, which means resource heavy to make that change. So just being aware that in order to take, for example, the simple detail of financial aid, extremely complicated, and if we have some of these delivery models that will work for the workforce, we need to have students enrolled in possibly three different universities and colleges at one time. Financial aid doesn't work that seamlessly, so it's manually done, too labor-intensive. So what we're looking at is actually revamping financial aid, which, again, will be resource-heavy at the beginning until the system is created, and then hopefully very efficient. So just to remember that in asking for resources now, we're really hoping to develop systems that will be very student-focused, student-friendly, and efficient in the future.
Thank you very, very much. Anything further, subcommittee members? Hearing nothing more, thank you both very, very much. And please, as your work progresses, please keep us informed, and you will know when the time is right, I'm sure, and we would like to have you back if that would be helpful.
Thank you
so much. Next, Michael, you're going to...
I wonder if we could skip around, because the chair of the committee is not here. I thought we'd be up about 2 o'clock.
Okay. We'll
see if the CCP...
Okay, sounds good.
Yeah, we're fine.
All right. Those of you who are following along on the agenda, we're going to move down to... job training collaborations between community colleges and businesses. And is this a panel, or because it's going to make for a large panel?
I think we can do two at a time.
Okay.
Do it that way.
Okay.
Okay.
And I don't know. Collecting them. Does anyone have an order that might be preferable?
John said he's ready.
I think we're ready to go. It's whatever order you'd like to go. You want to just do two, and two.
Okay. All right. We're putting this together on the wing here, and this is a session with 6 people down on the agenda, and we're thinking that we're going to call you up 2 at a time. Help me here. If there is an order that makes more sense, first rather than last, and the grouping would make a difference, please let me know. Absent anybody raising their hand, I'm going to ask that Michael Rasmussen and Carol Crislett, please come forward. Would like to welcome both of you to our subcommittee this afternoon. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairman Witt, and thank you, representatives. I'm Carol Chislett. I'm with Vigor Industrial, which is basically a ship repair firm on Swan Island in Portland. And we're here, both Mike and I, to tell you a good story. We've got 2 basic principles and workforce challenges to the prosperity of my company, Vigor Industrial. As you can imagine, my company, as well as many other companies, are seeing that in the next 5 to 10 years, much of our workforce is going to be retiring. The type of work that's done in ship repair is very physically demanding, and many of our workers are looking to retire in their early 60s, some of them even sooner. What maybe isn't known is that workers of that type, though they're working with their hands, they're getting dirty every day, it's still a profession, and it takes time to cultivate those skills. There can be anywhere from as much time as it takes to have a teacher, an engineer, a lawyer. It does take time to develop those skills. And we're really not seeing enough workers in the pipeline to meet the needs that my company and many others in the state are going to be facing. Unfortunately, at the high school level, there's not the kind of technical training that there used to be back when I was a kid. Our community college system is about the only source right now for vocational training, and this is really important to us. The kind of close partnering that we can do with the community colleges is the most effective way to try to assure that we have the kind of numbers that we're going to need. We need to be sure there are enough training programs to support the workers that we need in the upcoming years. The other principle here is that the foundation of our businesses is manufacturing, and the workforce is, we hope, has a broad range of skills, from welding, electrical, pipe fitting, carpentry. And that's important to my company, but further it's important to the state and developing the kinds of workforce that we need for the state to stay competitive. I see Representative Huff has a wind lapel pin on. A lot of the work that goes into your green energy, green industries right now is the core of the foundation our work needs to. The electrical, the welding, the mechanical, all of those things. Just because it's green energy doesn't mean it doesn't take a lot of dirty work. So we want to have the benefit of those kinds of jobs to provide to other businesses as we continue to grow our state, as well as to the workers themselves, as through developing those kinds of skills, they also have family wage jobs. So the development of the skilled workforce that we're talking about historically came down through, passed from one generation to another. And a lot of times workers would bring their sons and daughters into the workplace and train them up on those skills. That isn't always viable right now. And we are really facing a crossroads for our competitive advantage. And so I don't know how many of you are aware, but at our site down on Swan Island, Bigger Industrial has partnered with Portland Community College in the Swan Island Training Center. And right now that center is providing training for welders. It's a great program. We'd love to see more partnering and more of that kind of collaborative effort. Community colleges seem to be the best way to make that partnering. They're agile. They are responsive to the kinds of things that employers tell them about the skills that we want, the skills that we need, and they're able to pull programs together pretty quickly. So we believe that it's about the single most important thing we can do to advance the economy of our state over the next few years. And thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. I think what I'll do is ask Michael to give us his presentation, and then we'll open it up for a discussion with both of you.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Witt and representatives. My name is Mike Rasmussen. I'm the welding instructor down at the Swan Island Training Center with Portland Community College. This center we started, I was a full-time employee with Vigor Marine, part of the Vigor Industrial family in the shipyard. Portland Community College contacted me in 2008. They were looking for another facility so they could expand and try to take care of their wait list. They had so many people on their wait list that they were trying to find another location. So we found one in the shipyard. I eventually became an employee with Portland Community College, and I still work with Vigor also. In 2008, we opened the school. It's located inside the shipyard. It's in a small building, probably maybe about 3,000 square feet or so. I started out first summer of 08 with about 16 students full-time. And then in the fall, it jumped to 20. And now I'm at 22 full-time students. That's about as many as I can handle in there at one time. We're only running one shift right now. Since we started, I started out with a wait list of zero, and as of last Friday, my wait list now is 142 people. I get calls continuously. They want to come into the program. They're begging to get into our program. Fortunately, this coming fall, we're going to start a second shift, so I will be able to bring another 20 to 25 folks into the program, which is really going to be good. Of the 22 people I have now, I have 5 women in the class. And I have one shipyard person that is upgrading his skills so he can move up in the shipyard to a better position. I've had 17 students go to work since we started in 2008. Even with this economy, I think that's pretty good for just having one class. I don't know how many of you know of our program or what we're doing. I know that there's very few, if any, in the city of Portland that know about it. The word is getting out on the street now slowly, and as people find out, I'm getting inundated with people that I can't serve, but I'm trying.
Thank you very much. Yes, Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Mike, is it a one-year certificated program, or what do you offer?
It can be. We have one-year certificate, two-year certificate. Mostly, we are open entry, open exit, which means that a student, anybody, can contact and say, hey, I need to upgrade my skill in this particular process. Can you help me with that? Yes, I can. You can come in at any time during the term, and you can leave at any time during the term. We're the only community college in the Portland metro area that offers that program. The other ones, you have to wait until that particular training session comes up.
Okay, follow up?
Please.
Thank you. Carol. With 140 plus people, and you know, on the waiting list, and word is just now. I think Mike said something like word is just now kind of getting out on the street. And do you see this as the beginnings of filling your pipeline? And try to maybe answer that in conjunction with what is your pipeline need? And then one of the things that this committee seems to hear frequently is the lack of people in the pipeline, but it's quickly connected with the comment that you made that a lot of your current workers will be retiring in 5 to 10 years. If it takes a year to get through the program, so I get through the program, but there may not be a job for 9 more years, how are you guys working together to close that gap and educate potential future workers? Do you get where I'm coming from? I kind of see some gaps in there.
I think so. One of the things that I do know is that someone can complete the program that Mike has, and Vigor Industrial has hired several people that have come out of those programs. Those programs provide the foundational skills that are needed. It's a welding program, the foundational welding skills. They do not provide that individual 4 or 5 years worth of experience in ship repair, which is a unique creature. What ideally we need is folks that have that foundational skill that we can bring in and cultivate up, which would take
three, four, 5 years to make them fully skilled. And additionally, that's only one of the trades that we need for ship repair. We also need electrical skills. We need machining skills. We need pipe fitting. And ideally, we'd like to have someone who had a breadth of those skills so that instead of laying somebody off because the vessel we're working on right now has no need for electrical work, it's all pipe fitting or it's all welding, we would be able to move someone who had been working on the welding part of the project to the electrical part of the project instead of sending them home at the end of the...
Same problem we have in healthcare.
I was going to say, it sounds familiar, doesn't it?
I thought of that, actually, when you said that. I thought, so I understand what you're saying, and I've been in the human resources field for many years, and I've heard that people are retiring. We don't have the pipeline. I think there's more that could be done to assure that pipeline on both sides, on the side of the government and on the side of the employers.
Comment? I guess I just wanted to make sure that part of it, too, wasn't nervousness in that you're not seeing the whole picture of 15-year-olds in freshman industrial arts class learning basic welding. You're not seeing that happening at that stage. Therefore, you're nervous that when they're 20 or 22, they're not going to be in Mike's program either. And so that progression is really disjointed.
One of the concerns that we have felt is that because it's not happening at the high school level, there are fewer people that really understand the nature of the work and understand that it can provide a good family wage job. And I think we've seen that to some extent. No perfect answers.
Representative Holvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate this conversation. It seems like a very similar one that we've had in this committee before around our challenges, and certainly, you know, vocational education and getting the younger folks familiar with opportunities in a vocational field is extremely important. And you know, we've strived to accomplish some of those things in the past, and all oftentimes run into budget constraints, which keep these programs from getting funded, which is, you know, aggravating, to say the least. But also, you know, I'm just sitting here thinking because I happen to know an individual who's a shipwright, and you know, I didn't hear you use that terminology so much, but it seems like it sort of fits into your industry somewhat, and I know that there is an apprenticeship program for shipwrights, and I don't know if you're partnering with some of those entities as well. That I think there are some in Portland that have apprenticeship programs that, you know, make a commitment with the employer to ensure that they're employing a certain amount or a certain percentage of apprentices or interns or what have you in your current workforce to make sure that they're getting that on the job training and that they feel like there is a job for them. And you know, as much as the government can make, you know, spend money and create workforce training programs, there also needs to be a commitment from the employer to provide those job opportunities, which has always been one of my focuses. If we can't have those job opportunities for those apprentices or interns, the government spending money on the to get people trained up for that seems to be a waste in some respect, not in the broader sense of vocational education, but certainly in the specific field like you're talking about ship repair, shipwrights, and things like that. So I don't know if you're partnering with that kind of a program as well, where you actually do have, I think theirs is a 4-year program for a shipwright, not a 1-year certificate. For a welding process, but a larger scope. So can you speak to how your commitment to, you know, the long-term employment of an apprentice would be?
I must apologize. I'm not familiar with a shipwright apprentice program. Mm. And I'm not really familiar with that term.
Mm-hmm.
We have several apprentices that are with the electrical apprentice program, and we have some that have recently become journey level in that trade. Do you know anything about shipwrights?
Not. I don't know very much about them. I've been a welder all my life. I'm a product of the community college from the 60s. So, and I know from the welding standpoint, we do not have an apprenticeship program, a formal one anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Different unions have, some of the unions have apprenticeship programs, you know, in the Portland area, steam fitters, iron workers, but quite a few don't.
Yeah, interesting. I'm sure I could probably find a contact for that if you were so interested.
Well, I would probably look at it because I don't know. I've not heard the term. Mm-hmm. I don't know how similar it is to the kinds of things that our business needs.
I would be quite certain that Representative Holby is the perfect contact for that. So, Representative Dembro.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thanks for coming and talking about the program. Once again, we have proof of the excellence of Portland Community College. its creativity, its flexibility, its...
shameless plug.
Great. Actually a couple of things. First of all, the issue of the challenge of getting technical education to the younger students, you know, to the high school and even middle school students, is something that also that I'm going to be talking about once my partner shows up. But it's something that we're also looking at as, a real need for more partnerships to provide opportunities for young people to get them, not only to get them ready and to give them the technical skills, but also, as you say, Carol, to just make them aware that these are good jobs waiting for them, and, to know that that this is a good career field for them. Do you see a way that you could extend this program in some way so that it could provide some orientation for young people about the, the kind of trade that you're doing there? Some sort of, I don't know what, after school program or, and some kind of maybe very short term summer orientation kind of thing. I mean, in some way that you could extend it in that direction.
I like the idea, and I'm sorry to respond with what might be perceived as a negative. In the ship repair business, there's lots of safety precautions, and we don't actually let people go out there that are under 18. And so I don't know if there's a way to work out something with PCC that would give at least some introduction and then possibly some tours or some exposure. I would not be comfortable with having people younger than 18 involved in the work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fair. And I have another question. Just, in terms of the commitment that Bigger has made to this project and the resources that Bigger is applying to it, Could you just kind of review that for us?
Some of the details I'm not closely familiar with. Mike may know more than I with regard to that.
I'll give you the best I can.
Vigor
provided the building. Vigor did all of the installation of the electrical and piping that we needed. PCC provided the machines, and I also have some machines that welding machines that Vigor supplied to me. I get my scrap steel, most of my scrap steel comes from the shipyard. So the students are actually working on pieces of material that are being used or have been used out in the shipyard. Mm-hmm. So they get various sizes, various shapes, painted, new, rusty, whatever. As far as maybe to answer your question or to give a little light on your question as to how we introduce people to this, I give a lot of tours during the year. And just 2 weeks ago, I gave a tour to 25 high school. They were from Mount Hood Community College, excuse me. They were just getting ready to graduate their welding program. I'm giving another tour this coming Thursday to the Oregon tradeswomen. I do those tours for them about once every 3 months throughout the year. We've been contacted by other schools, and I'm open. I give tours of the yard. Can't go on to vessels, but I show them, and I try to describe to them how things work here, what we do. With our school located within the shipyard, we're in an industrial site. So we have the cranes, the forklifts, we have all this commotion going on down there. And it's really I found in the last 2 years, this is really a good immersion process for the students I have to see if this is an industry they even want to get involved with. I mean, they're right in there firsthand. They're watching U.S. Barge put a barge together from day one until they launch it. They see this every single day. And they are always asking me questions. I take them on tours. We go on impromptu tours in the evening, walking around the yard. You know, I've got them immersed as best I can into the environment.
Thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Yeah, and let me just say, Mike, that I was so excited when I heard that PCC was in some form moving back down to Swan Island, because it's something that it's rectifying what I consider a mistake that was made 25 years mm-hmm. ago. And, you know, really that's where the action is. That's where those courses should be offered. Going back to the question of the commitment that the employer is making, I assume you got some release time when this was all being set up to work on this. Before you became a PCC employee, as this was all being talked about, I mean,
yeah, we had an initial meeting and with PCC, and after that initial meeting, Frank Foti came down and said, make it work. And so then we had a second meeting, and we were off and running. It took us 90 days from the time that PCC and Vigor agreed to this partnership to get the building going. I pretty much put most of the building together, and it took us about 90 days, and we were up and running. We had our first full class in June of 2008. We started the process in March of 2008. So it went very quickly. And I think, you know, we did it. I think anybody else could do it if they just sit down and cooperate, you know, and talk with each other.
Representative Dembro just talked about a quarter century old mistakes, and I think this our subcommittee has heard repeatedly mistakes that perhaps have been made in our public school system in terms of eliminating what I used to refer to as the industrial arts programs, but vocational technical education.
And we have heard numerous employers come before us and tell us that those are basic skills that are gathered for a lifetime. They're also an exposure to future careers. And Mike, you've, I think, you know, told us that you're exposing people as adults to a career. And I mean, I just think it's terribly unfortunate that we didn't pique this interest several years earlier, and that we've had to wait until they are adults before we can begin that education and training process. The problem that this subcommittee has run up against, and there are several of the members here who have taken it upon their own in the past to try and promote the reemergence of vocational technical education, and then reality smacks us right in the face. And that it is extremely expensive for your local school district that has lost the program then to go back out and, as you described, Mike, you know, buy the equipment, find the room in the school, hire additional staff to do this. It is just exceedingly, once a school system loses that capacity, it is extremely expensive to start it up again. So that's lesson number one. Don't lose it if you have it. But given that many of our schools no longer have this kind of programming, I know that, Carol, you mentioned the importance of partnering here, and it seems that that's perhaps the only way that we're going to continue programs such as the both of you are carrying out. What I'm wondering is if you've thought about who owns the partnering process. It seems to me that we need a Frank Foti who comes and says, you know, make it happen. And unfortunately, school systems around the state aren't fortunate enough to have a Frank in every school district or whatever to in fact make it happen. And I know that again, several members of our subcommittee have been interested in alternative approaches where we have brought, or we have at least supported this partnering process. And I know that the ACE Academy is one model that that we've looked at, and I think Representative Holvey, you've even found of recent that that funding has become a problem there with ACE Academy. And so every time, as policymakers, we try and support moves towards filling that pipeline that you've both discussed, we run headlong into funding problems. And I can tell you that it has been, as a policymaker, exceedingly frustrating to see a need, to see a very significant short gap in terms of our state's ability to be able to meet the needs of its employer community as well as its workforce community. And so I'm wondering if you have sat down and given some thought. Who owns the partnering process? Who is the Frank Foti? Because quite frankly, we've had numbers of people come in and say, I'm willing to help out, but we need that leader. And who's that Frank Foti? Without putting you on the spot.
It's going to be somebody that believes in training and getting the younger people
mm-hmm.
into the workforce,
mm-hmm.
regardless of what industry they're in. That's the way I feel.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be somebody that believes in it. And in this case, Frank believed in it.
Yes, yes.
And he does continue to believe in it. continued to look at other ways to partner with PCC to expand what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
That effort has not stopped.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. One thing, I participate in the metal skills panel with work systems, and I think that a lot of the work that work systems does is helpful. And I'm sure there's more they do that I don't know about.
I would ask that as our other panelist members come up here for the remainder of the afternoon, if you would give some thought about who helps drive this partnership process. I think we would be the beneficiaries of that. I know I don't want to leave this subject without noting that that John Chandler has appeared before our subcommittee in the past and has offered to help drive that process, as well as have a number of other folks from business and labor. So with that, do we have anything else from our subcommittee at this point? I'd like to thank you both very, very much for your presentation and for helping us fill this pipeline.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
Your efforts.
Thank you.
If any of you have questions in the future, you know, feel free to contact me. I'm more than happy to take you through the facility if you're up that direction.
Wonderful.
Show you what we're doing.
Yeah. Thank you for that offer.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
Good afternoon to both of you. I'd like to call up now, please, Mike Hatton from Solark and Roger Ebbage from Lane Community College. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Representative Witt. Representatives, my name is Roger Ebbage. I am the Director of Energy and Water Programs at Lane Community College in Eugene. And my purpose for being here today is to tell you about our program, and then I'll introduce my colleague, Mike Hatton, from Solark Architecture and Engineering, who will discuss our relationship with our industry. And my Frank Foley is Eugene Water and Electric Board.
Very good.
Just to get that off the table. At Lane Community College, we offer a two-year degree, Associate of Applied Science, an Associate of Applied Science two-year degree in energy management. And within that program, we have three options. They are energy efficiency in commercial buildings, excuse me, renewable energy, specifically solar water heating and solar electricity installation. And then our third is resource conservation management, which is a combination of the other two, plus some water conservation information. We also have a second degree in water conservation technology. What I'd like to do is give you a little bit of program history. I think it'll provide a valuable frame to the conversation. We began in 1980 through a National Science Foundation grant. You'll recall in that era, Jimmy Carter was just starting the Department of Energy, and in 1979, I think it was April 17th, declared war on energy. The problem that he had was that he didn't have a workforce to fight that war, and so a very creative physics professor at Lane applied for a National Science Foundation grant, got it, and his specific mission was to train residential analysts and solar water heating installers. The program ran until 1988. At which time it was put on the shelf because essentially the labor market dried up due to national administration policies. And the Bonneville Power Administration came to Lane in 1992 and asked if we would reopen our program because they felt that there would be a labor market, very specifically in commercial energy efficiency. We ran on a grant from the Bonneville Power Administration up until about 1998. Our grant was a three-year grant. We were taken into the college's general fund, and in 1998, the college removed us from their general fund because the impacts of Measure 5 had started to take hold, and we were the last program allowed into the general fund and consequently the first program to be asked to leave. That would have been our, at this time, 12-year mistake that Representative Dembro was referring to as his 25-year mistake, and we could see that it probably would have been a mistake, and so we went to the college's vice president, who at that time was Dr. Mary Spielde, she's now the president of the college, and asked if we found our own financing, would it be possible to continue to run our program as a very traditional two-year degree program on campus. And she did a couple of back-of-the-envelope calculations and saw that it would probably be a winner for Lane and no money going out, a lot of money coming in. And so she allowed us to stay on campus, and we've been running successfully using our own resources. And again, Chair Witt, this is our Frank Foley. The Eugene Water and Electric Board stepped in and has been providing us an annual grant of around $125,000 to $132,000 a year. We're on a five-year contract with them, so every 5 years we kind of take a look at that again to see if it's still a good idea. And they've been very forthcoming with the fact that it has been a good idea. One of the downsides to being on soft money is that our staffing has never been full-time contracted staff except for myself. We have had adjuncts teaching in our program for the entire time that we've been offering courses since 92. And that has a good and a not-so-good side to it. The good side is that these are practitioners who work in the industry and consequently know what should be taught in our courses. The downside to it is that when the industry starts to gear up, as we're seeing now in energy and green building, they get busy as well. And so trying to stop the revolving door for adjuncts has really been a problem. So one of our areas of concern is full-time staffing. I'd like to now go to our growth because I think it's pretty astounding. We've had the energy industry is very cyclical. It depends on who's in the national administration, who's operating the White House at the time, as to whether or not there's going to be any funding at all for renewables and energy efficiency. And when the right administration gets in there, we're fully funded. When the industry is fully funded, when the other administration gets in there, not so, I don't mean to offend anybody, not so fully funded. So it's been very cyclical. We've had huge classes, and we've had classes that barely allowed us to operate. Currently, since 2008, we've been in an unbelievable growth spurt. We bring students in every year. Fall term, we bring in a cohort of students. And in 2008, we had 30 students come into the program. 2009, we had 60 come into the program. And last year, we had 90 come into the program. And this year, 2010, fall of 2010, we'll have another 90 come into the program. And we will... we already have 65, 67 people on our waiting list. So our growth has been unbelievable. Our placement has also been pretty robust ever since we've been operating the program. We can boast an 85 to 90% placement rate. That's different than our completion rate. Our placement is what we're concerned about. And although we emphasize completion, students come to us to find an occupation that they can believe in, and employment is their end game, so we pay attention to that. Pay is at about $45,000 to $50,000 a year starting, so it's a very good starting wage. We've seen that come to students who have nothing more than a two-year degree. We have a student body that has, or a student population that oftentimes will have a four-year degree. We've had lawyers come through the program. We've had medical folks come through the program. We currently have a PhD in the program. This guy's got a degree in robotics engineering and is truly a rocket scientist. He worked for NASA before he came to us. We get guidance from our industry advisory committee that all career technical programs need to have in the community college system. They are an invaluable resource for us because they give us that guidance that we need to make sure that, that we're actually doing what we are supposed to be doing, and that is training people for current employment, but also taking a look at emerging technologies and making sure that when we are training folks that we're not training for them for yesterday's building environment, as you can well imagine, and has happened all across Oregon, that the new buildings are being built with some pretty high-tech technology. Excuse me. And so our advisory committee gives us that level of guidance. We have them looking at our curriculum and helping us staff our classrooms with adjuncts. And I think at this time I'll introduce my colleague, Michael Hatton.
Chair Witt, representatives, it's my pleasure to be here this afternoon.
Welcome.
I'm going to talk a little bit about just a brief overview of our firm and really a little bit of how we've come to rely on the energy management program at Lane.
Mike, would you formally introduce yourself to the record, please?
Yes, I would.
Thank you.
Mike Hatton. I'm a principal at Solark Architecture and Engineering.
Thank you very much.
I am also one of the adjunct instructors that Roger was referring to.
Thank you.
I'd like to conclude my presentation after a brief review of just sharing a few of my observations about this energy efficiency market. Now, Roger was mentioning that the program has several focuses these days, energy efficiency being probably the first of the three, and it's a area of our local market that I've dedicated the last 29 years, all of my professional career to, so I have actually been a firsthand witness to the cyclical nature of our state and regional efforts to work with energy efficiency in the built environment. And I think there are several observations that I would hope would be significant to consider as we're thinking about where we're going to move from today in training the workforce that's going to do this kind of work. We are a small firm. We have we have 24 total employees currently, and we do a wide variety of work: architecture, engineering, and a significant element of specialty-focused work in both existing and new construction to improve the energy performance of commercial and institutional buildings. That is our focus. Our markets that we serve, not only in Western Oregon, but generally the Pacific Northwest and the Intermountain West, so we bring a little bit of a broader perspective than just our local region. Currently, we have 11 focused and dedicated staff that work just on the energy efficiency aspects of our activities, and of those six, I can proudly say, are former graduates of the Lane Community College program. And so just by doing the basic statistics there, the basic arithmetic, you can see well over a quarter of our staff right now are graduates of the Lane Community College program. So speaking as a professional, I can say that without this program in existence since Roger became director, we would clearly have suffered in terms of finding talented and capable professional technical staff to do this kind of work. A couple of the observations. First, I like to characterize it in terms of the technical need versus the market response for this kind of work. If you go out into the buildings, I would venture to say that there is not a commercial building out there, including our state capitol, that as we sit here couldn't do significant improvement and work in that building to reduce energy use. We have spent the last 25 years in our region working on this. It is the first baby step towards the technical need. So if you look at it just from a technological standpoint and an operation standpoint, we do not have anywhere close to the capability, the workforce capability, to match that technical need. I argue in other forums that this could represent a 100-fold increase easily over our existing technical staff. Now, that said, the market response is anywhere close to aligning with that technical need. The market response has traditionally been an external influence, primarily under the umbrella of the electric utilities in our region,
secondarily under the umbrella of state and other incentives, usually through state offices, energy offices. We're probably in a reasonable balance for the market response, at least currently. I think another appropriate observation is that this energy market is a market at the threshold of significant transition. And so the workforce question in my mind is meeting this challenge of aligning future workforce to a market that could respond very rapidly. If we think back to the conversations that were happening across the lunch table when gasoline was $4 a gallon, we saw those same kind of responses in the commercial building sector. A change in the energy market that is related but not completely connected to issues of energy cost can dramatically change the demand in the market and very rapidly change it. And so we have a challenge of how we're going to respond to a market that could be very elastic, could respond very quickly to changes that we're not necessarily in control of, and how are we going to provide the talent and capability to meet those needs. And I want to offer one last observation, which was made by our previous guests here, that the nature of the training of this workforce, this is a technical professional career. This is not a career that someone can go to a community college, get 2 years of training, and go out and be the building energy expert. The amount of work that and education that continues in those first 2 to 10 years on the job is consequential and potentially the most critical piece of this training of this workforce. So we have to be thinking about how we're going to provide that initial entry into the career, but anticipate in enough advance to allow that on-the-job training to happen so that we can get enough folks to the place where they truly are energy experts in a manner that is likely to respond to the ultimate need.
Very good.
Thank you. Questions or comments?
Yes, Representative Dembro, please.
Great. Mike, I'd like to ask you, Mike, the same question that I asked the previous panel, and that is the nature of the participation that your firm has, you know, with the program, in terms of supporting it, investing in it, you know, what kind of, you know, financial or release time, you know, kind of investment is your firm making in a program like that, and what do you see as appropriate? You know, we're trying to figure out what the best way is to make these partnerships work. And so what kind of investment we should be looking for from the industrial commercial partners?
Chair Witt, Representative Dembro, excellent question. And it is an important aspect of this program that currently exists that neither Roger nor I mentioned, which is a formal structured internship set of internships, and this has been part of this program since 1992, and that, I would say, is the first way that we, our particular firm, but we're certainly not alone in this, participate and offer both on-the-job training opportunities and paid internship opportunities for the students in this two-year degree program. And I think that's a model that really we should encourage a larger adaption of that model to our professional and industrial partners in the state. Secondarily, I teach in the program. I mean, just to cut to the quick, it is a financial contribution and a personal passion. And I would suggest to our very talented group of energy professionals that we do have in this state, that is something each and every one of them could consider in terms of offering to the workforce training activities over the next 2 decades.
Thank you. Gentlemen, I'd like to ask you, too, if either of you have any thoughts about the partnership that we were discussing earlier and who might help drive those partnerships and the creation of career technical training and education for Oregon's workforce.
Well, let me say that I was listening very closely to your remarks because my bachelor's degree is in industrial arts education, and I've started, sorry, native Oregonians, but I'm a Californian, and was laid off because of Proposition 13 down there, something that we went through here, and I agree wholeheartedly with you about the dissolvement of the industrial arts programs because they never will come back, mostly because of the expense. To answer your question, which is an excellent question, I'm not sure how we drive that conversation for partnerships. I mean, we're asking a lot of our practitioners to as Mike was saying, teach in our programs. That is a very tight bond that we have with our energy community in Eugene. We get practitioners teaching in our program, and I consider that the what has made it a success. And I don't know if you're aware of the difference between community college adjunct salary and professional engineering billable hours salary, but there's a wide range of difference between the two, and so to get that level of partnership from our community, I think is a huge investment. For direct funding, I am not quite sure of where to go with an answer for that. I will tell you that the Eugene Water and Electric Board stood right up when the program was on the cliff and we were about ready to go. The Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance provided us our bridge funding through which we created the Northwest Energy Education Institute, which has been our source of finding funds. We have three or four different certification programs that address the needs of our workforce in not only Oregon, but in the Northwest. And because we are in this unique discipline of energy, we have a population that seeks out our services. That's over and above what we do in the two-year degree programs. Our partners are our industry, and our partners are our practitioners, and they are helping us stay alive. Mm-hmm. I do want to say that we, since 2009, when our enrollment started to increase, the college started providing us with our tuition reimbursement. Our classes were full, and so essentially any overage than what we're normally seeing was paid for through tuition. And so the college has really come to the game on that one. But outside of what we can get from our resources, the Energy Trust of Oregon is another partner. We're providing them a service, essentially. So they have good reason to be there.
Thank you very much.
I would like to suggest an educational partnership that I have not heard mentioned yet, but I think is particularly worthy of consideration here, and that is partnering with conventional four-year institutions of higher education. I think the opportunity to take a two-year degree program such as Lane Community College has and marry it with specialty initiatives within our schools of engineering, mm-hmm. our school of architecture, is an untapped potential and will likely be a necessary partnership if we're really going to meet the market needs that I see.
And Mike, not to put you on the spot here, but as someone who is in the profession, do you see any roadblocks for the person who comes out of the two-year program going into a four-year program as we're currently structured?
Chair Witt, the short answer is no.
Okay,
we actually have had students who do that and who have done that in a number of professional schools across the Northwest.
That's encouraging. That's encouraging to hear that. Because I know the governor has taken a look at some of the barriers that that we face as a state to be able to make education seamless, and we do have there are some areas where our state does have some challenges that we need to address that. But I am very encouraged to hear that. Thank you. Anything further? Not hearing anything, gentlemen. Thank you so very, very much.
and the next panel. Gerald Hamilton, president of Klamath Community College, has been with us before, of course. Most people will recognize Gerald. And Susan Wolf, chief academic officer from my home, Columbia Gorge Community College, and we appreciate the two of you coming and sharing with us also today. So be sure and introduce yourself for the record, and whichever one of you, did you guys flip a coin to see who was going first?
We gave all of our coins to the parking meter.
Support the local economy, thank you.
Okay. Dr. Susan Wolf, I'm Chief Academic Officer at Columbia Gorge Community College, as Vice Chair Huffman just said, and it's my honor to be here today, and I've enjoyed hearing all of the other presentations today because my primary focus these days is on our renewable energy technology program, but we also have a wonderful healthcare program, so everything seems to be marrying up today, if you will. I'd like to first go to your question about the partnerships, if I may. And I have scribbles all over the place. When we developed this program, we looked at it in 2006, so almost 4 years ago now, and very important partners in the development of our renewable energy technology program was the Mid-Columbia Council of Governments, so our workforce partner. And since then, the Mid-Columbia Economic Development District has formed a bi-state renewable energy zone. But most importantly, I would have never gotten that program off the ground if industry hadn't stepped up to the plate. They drove the development of the program. We did a needs assessment thanks to the Community College Workforce Development Office and the Governor's Strategic Workforce Plan, where we did a statewide needs assessment and determined that there was a need at that time for 360 well-trained technicians. And these technicians do need the same skills as those people that work in the shipyards. Now, we don't do the welding and the pipe fitting, et cetera, but a lot of those same skills, you know, could apply. And when we saw and we heard that number for rural Oregon, that's huge. I mean, in I-5 corridor, that's not very many employees, but to have 360 family wage jobs come to rural Oregon, that was just huge. Well, I have to say that by now, we just did another needs assessment. We updated that, and that's now up to 720 by the year 2011. So again, that just continues to grow. So I think the important partnerships and who leads that is everybody. I have to say, though, that industry has to lead the development of the curriculum. Industry has to continue to want to help us. If I hadn't had industry support, like I said before, the program wouldn't have gotten off the ground. We had to close down two programs to find money to develop this one. And in the ensuing years, since we started the credit program in 2007, industry has donated over $1.4 million to this program. Cash donations, equipment donations, scholarships, paid internships, and what we call climb tests for the people who need to go find out whether they can climb those towers or not. That's plus all the time. That's not including the time or when they shut down one of the turbines for our students to make that climb. In comparison,
the top and their heart's still beating.
Mm-hmm. They get the job. That's right. Yeah, that's true. So industry has donated $1.4 million. The college has spent $837,000. So that's, you know, state money. That's tuition. That's local taxpayer dollars. CCWD has given us $420,000 because they helped us build an interim lab for this program. The U.S. Department of Labor has given us almost $2 million. We received an initial $1.67 from the U.S. Department of Labor to double the capacity of the program. Since then, we've just been given another $350,000 to purchase a training nacelle, which is the top part of the turbine where all the mechanics are that produce the electricity. And the Department of Energy has given us $237,000 also for training equipment. So you look across the expanse, and it's the college that's putting in their dollars, students paying their tuition, the state through the governor's office, CCWD, industry, Department of Labor, Department of Energy. So when you look at all of those partners, you've got to have somebody who's saying, how can I pull everybody together? And I would say at this point it's been a close collaboration between the college and our workforce partner. So that's one of the things I'd like to say on that piece. Just to give you an example of the industry people who have been involved just in that program, we have Vestas America, which is located in Portland, Iberdrola, located in Portland, PGE, located in Portland, Anexco, Canon Power out of San Diego, Suzlon, headquartered in Chicago, Caithness Energies, who is just now coming into the state with a large wind farm that's being built outside of Arlington now that the moratorium has been lifted.
If I could interrupt.
And the Air Force out of it.
And they're coming in from where? I'm just curious.
The companies?
Yeah, the new company.
The last new companies. Canon Power came from San Diego. Caithness, I believe, is New York. That's building the largest wind farm in the country in eastern Oregon. Suzlon Corporation was Chicago. Bonneville Power Administration, we all know our friends at BPA. Moventus, they produce and manufacture gearboxes, the large gearboxes. They're here in Portland. Siemens Corporation comes out of Texas. Cardinal Glass is a local, well, actually, it's a national company, but we have a manufacturing plant both in the Dalles and in Hood River. In situ, I think you're all familiar with in situ over in White Salmon and Bingen.
Mm-hmm.
CloudCap Technologies, a local Hood River firm. And then Blattner Construction. And so it's a huge industry, and those companies are coming to Oregon. To date, it has been a $9 billion investment into the state of Oregon by these companies. So that's large.
That is extremely large.
Extremely large.
And Susan, I recognize that I've interrupted you, and I don't want to throw your presentation here, but if you could make a mental check note and maybe circle around at the end of your testimony and maybe suggest, in addition to the fact that the wind blows like crazy in this area, what are some of the other reasons that these companies may have chosen to locate here?
Okay.
yes.
Thank you, Chair Witt. And also, Susan, if you could identify, there are some people within our body that don't think that wind energy, renewables in general, but wind specifically, create permanent jobs. And you listed a lot of companies. Some of those, Iberdrola, for example, actually has world headquarters based in Portland. So if you could, I don't know if you have any numbers with you, could elaborate a little bit. They're not all Blattner construction jobs that in 3 years are going to go away.
Right.
A number of these jobs, and I don't know the number, I know Iberdrola had 350 plus permanent state, Oregon state employees. So if you could differentiate between temporary construction and jobs that stay in Oregon.
Okay. I'm going to do my best on that because the numbers with the companies who are headquartered here in Portland, I'm not sure if I still have the numbers because they too suffered, you know, a little bit of a decline when we went into the recession. I believe at one time that Vestas had almost 500 permanent employees in the Portland area. That's at their corporate headquarters. Iberdrola has to be very similar to that. PGE, of course, we know they have a lot of different energy production as big as they are. Suzlon has a smaller workforce in the state, but I'm going to say it's probably around 50. Canon Power, they don't have a headquarter building here, but they're the ones who built the wind farm right above Maryhill Museum on the Washington side of the river. So they've got permanent technicians there. Anexco, again, they don't have a headquarters building here, but they have several permanent staff in the gorge in the area. The construction jobs alone for the wind farms that have currently been built have brought in 8,250 construction jobs. Now, that's large. You know, it's like when you build a large interstate highway and people come in and they're here for a period of years and then they leave. They do leave. But they did bring a lot of economic development to our region. Currently, we have 450 full-time O&M jobs. Those are our technician jobs out on the wind farms. These are family wage jobs. Our graduates leave with the ability to earn anywhere from $19 to $36 an hour when they leave our program. So that's, you know, definitely family wage job. The landowners where these wind turbines are sited, To date, they've had royalties come in between $60 and $100 million. This is allowing our wheat farmers and our cattle ranchers to continue business, something that, you know, every year goes up and down as the market changes, and it's allowing them to stay in business. There's also been $717 million worth of property tax revenue. So that's, you know, it's had a big, big impact on our region. I'd like to go back to our renewable energy program. When we started the credit program in 2007, we had 34 students enrolled. In 2008-09, we had 84 students enrolled, so it went from 24 to 84. And then in 09-10, we had 104, and we expect that same number to continue. Again, that expansion was in large part thank you to the U.S. Department of Labor, who gave us a three-year grant to expand that and hire more faculty. So you can see what a difference that has made. Tuition-wise, other people have mentioned tuition here. For the first time, because of budget reasons, the college is going to charge a differential fee to students who are in the Renewable Energy Technology Program, an extra $200 a quarter. And for our nursing students, we're going to start charging an extra $300 to $500. They're expensive programs to run, but we feel that those students leave and are able to get fairly well-paying jobs. Difficult decision to make, but to help balance budget, that's one of the things we were looking at. The other thing I'd like to say, when we were talking about or hearing from the folks at the shipyards, how nimble the community colleges are, for our renewable energy technology program, we're in the fourth program revision in 3 years. And that's because every time we have an advisory committee meeting, the industry comes in and says what more they need or what they don't need anymore. And so if you stop and think about how long it takes to develop curriculum and get it approved, to have four revisions in 3 years, I always say it's like that YouTube video where you're building an airplane while you're flying it. We're not only building it and flying it, we're taking it apart before it ever gets done, just in order to meet industry's needs. Who else do I want to ask?
Can I ask
a question?
Please.
Okay.
What's your help?
Yes.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Susan,
yes.
What are some of the reasons for the changes? Just technology changes are so rapid or unanticipated things?
The reasons that they come in for us, like when we originally looked at the program, we said, do they need to have any education and training on high-voltage electricity? And they said, no, that somebody else takes care of that. And in 3 months, they were back saying, whoops, we need to have them have a base knowledge of high voltage. So as the turbine technology changes, the skills that that their technicians need have to change. But as the industry is growing, in this country, it's a brand new industry. And so as they themselves are developing and growing, they're recognizing that they want that technician. Because when you climb 300 feet in the air, you better have a pretty good idea of what tools you're going to need, which means you better have a pretty good idea of what problems you're going to go diagnose and fix, because you're not going to go up and down that ladder too many times to go get a different tool. And then safety requirements, you know, as we really build that out, and with OSHA requirements, you know, we continually upgrade and update what kind of safety training that we're providing. So that's just a little bit of my story today.
Very good. Thank you so much. Again, just kind of bringing us back around, did you have any comments as to why...
why they're locating?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I just realized I didn't say that. You're right. The wind blows like crazy out there. The other thing is that land is available, and the people out on the farms and the ranches, they're not objecting to the turbines being sited.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where you come into a more populated area, people begin to get a little bit, a different view of that. But the other thing is they recognize that a rural workforce, people who have already chosen to live in rural America and want to stay there, train the rural people, and then they know they're going to be there, and they're not going to lose their workforce as quickly. So that's another thing. Naturally, having the Bonneville Power electrical grid, that's why the Pacific Northwest is as far along with wind energy We don't have as much wind capability as Montana and the Dakotas or Wyoming even, but they don't have the transmission lines, and we're very fortunate that we had the ability, not as much as we need, but we had a real good start on that compared to other states.
And I suspect you might be a little too modest. I'm sure the community college plays a role in attracting some of these companies as well.
Well, I think we do, because wherever we go, you'll see people wearing wind turbine pins on their lapels. And that is the Undersecretary of Education and different people. So, yes, we work very hard with the Dalles Outreach Team, working with our congressional delegation. We're continually going out. And, for instance, when Cadence Energies, when the moratorium was lifted, we had letters out and phone calls to those people inviting them to campus. And we need to do that because we need to keep asking people for money. So I'm just going to be blunt about that, as we have to play nice in the beginning and invite people to come to the table so that we can give something to them and they in turn can give something back to us.
Certainly. Susan, thank you so very much. President Hamilton.
Well, thank you, Chairman Witt and Vice Chair Huffman and members of the committee. My name is Gerald Hamilton. I'm the president of Klamath Community College, and I take a little bit more micro approach than Susan here today. I can't match those numbers. But what I do want to talk about is how that save one business in Klamath Falls, most of our companies are small, you know, and we hear about them being the bread and butter of our economy, and we really believe that to be true in Klamath Falls. Many of our companies have single-digit employees and don't have the kind of numbers that you would see, you know, maybe in the Portland area and you've heard about here this afternoon. But that's where our students are going to be working. Those are our employers for our future. So, we have several examples of our campus and numerous examples of where we want to be, but I thought the best example we could talk about today is a new diesel program. This is one of several programs that we be scheduled to begin in the fall. To be successful, a diesel program for us has to train students to not only fix construction equipment, you know, the cats and the things that you see if you go to PCC's diesel program, which is wonderful, but they also, the trucks, but it also has to fix the agricultural equipment, which is far more prevalent in our community than others. It's not uncommon to see harvesters driving down the highway all the time in Klamath Falls. And we like that, and subject to them having water, as we all know, those equipment will be needed to be fixed. So to accomplish this, we brought 23 different businesses together and asked them for advice. These 23 businesses represented auto dealers, auto repair shops, truck service centers, and farm implement dealers. These folks have partnered with us to design curriculum. Many have or will furnish us with equipment and supplies. Diesel engines are very expensive to try to train folks on, and help us furnish our new laboratory, and eventually provide internships and on-the-job training, and eventually hire our graduates. This is the kind of way that we partner with business, and I want to get to your question about whose responsibility the partnering is. Sir.
Thank you.
But this is the way we partner with business, to bring them together. The diesel program for us was a program that was dropped at our neighboring four-year institution in the late 80s and was one that that our community almost demanded that we do as we break more heavily into our professional career technical programs. There wasn't a time that I didn't talk to our community that I wasn't asked about when we are going to start a diesel program. So we kind of did that. We know there are jobs. We know these folks, these 23 business partners that are designing the curriculum to be varied so that we can train these people to work on all this equipment, you know, are ready to and stand willing to hire our folks in our community. We also have other programs. We could talk about our LPN program, licensed practical nursing program, the same way. Our elder care folks came to us and asked us to establish that program. That will be on by next spring. So almost every program that we're talking about, and we have several in the queue, are communities, you know, community requests, many of them, and are sponsored in the same exact way. To get to your question about partnering, on my staff, and I've got a small staff, I'm a small college in a small rural community, but I have two people that are working full-time in a workforce department that that's job is to do a couple of different things. Number one, do contract training for businesses. We do a lot of contract training. But it's also how can to establish partnerships that we can bring back to our college to maximize the resources, recognizing that, that Klamath Falls is a resource, you know, poor community, and that we have to work together to be able to get things done that we need to get done. So I have two people out there hustling those jobs, and that's exactly what I ask them to do. That's on their job description, go hustle, because that's exactly what we ask them to do. The other partnership that I would like to talk about a little bit in these programs, and not so much the diesel program, but in my auto program, construction management program, we will be partnering with our K-12 partners to bring students to our campus, assuming we can continue to get those early classes done at the high school. It's hard for us to bring freshmen out for Auto 1, for example. But if we can keep those classes at the high school, then we're able to bring those folks on our campus to do those latter years. And to help them, that helps them, helps us. It only provides us a future classes, you know, a future pool for our students, although, believe me, we have wait lists and don't need a lot more students, but clearly it helps our students, helps the community. So we're also trying to partner with our K-12 partners, and so hopefully that we can be in the middle and work both directions and come out with a positive effect on our folks in our area. If there are any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
All right. Subcommittee members, any questions or comments for our two panelists? I'm just curious, President Hamilton. I think I heard you say that it's difficult for you to turn freshmen out for Auto 1?
Well, what we have, Chairman, what we have in our situation is a very small lab that, and you know, for us to be able to work in the early stages where, you know, and I have to admit, my ex-career, one of my past lives, I was a K-12 superintendent, so I know a little about the K-12 world. The early shops are lawnmowers. It's like how to do small engines. It's getting established in the auto field, for example. It's really hard for us to go down that low and do that and still maximize use of our shops and still train the array of people that we're trying to train to be able to be out there employable. So we're hoping that we can continue to do that at the high school level, and it allows us to take the juniors and senior level students who are at least 16 in our campus and get them in the more advanced programs and be more productive that way. It's a model that's not new to us, but it's certainly something that we're working real hard to do, and I believe in thoroughly, having been in that K-12 system before.
Can I follow up to that?
Please.
Chair, thanks. Jerry, so would you say that your local K-12 districts have the capacity to offer those first 2 years? I mean, that a 2+2 kind of relationship is viable?
Chair Witt, Representative Dimbro, I think it is becoming more and more difficult for them to do. I mean, having been that and had to cut budgets in the K-12, I am sympathetic to the fact that those are the more difficult programs to keep. They're more expensive. Oftentimes they have fewer students in them. You know, we fund schools on ADM and the K-12. So it's becoming more and more difficult. And I think it just... what it means for us is we have to work harder and try harder and do a better job of partnering, as it were, to be able to keep as much of that as we possibly can, and that's our goal.
Just to follow up, and so would you say that your labs, I mean your facilities, your shops are fully utilized? I mean, is there any kind of potential for co-locating facilities with the K-12?
Hopefully down the line, and one of the things I'd like to do is suggest a big thank you for the capital that you've allowed community colleges to have, because our lab will be new, and right now we're putting together a lab that will house auto, diesel, and construction management, three brand-new programs on our campus, and we are already way undersized. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, we're doing a little tap dance with our creditors right now to make sure that we can get it through. So I wish that I had a shop that was, you know, 100,000 square feet. I don't. And so, you know, I have to be able to maximize my space. That doesn't mean that we can't use their shops. We have partners now. We partnerships with them and trying to work out ways to make that happen in our two K-12 school districts that we serve.
had another question. I just lost it. anything else from our subcommittee? Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Certainly appreciate your assistance. Next, we're going to have a status report on career and technical education, and Representative Dembro, if you'd please lead that.
Yes. And Dembro, you too.
With Representative Dembro is Deborah Barnes. Welcome.
Hello. Assuming you want to go first.
Yeah, well, I'll just get things set up. Mr. Chair, honored colleagues, I'm Michael Dembro, House District 45, Northeast Portland, Park Rose, and the city within the city of Maywood Park. I'm here because of Representative Esquivel. You'll probably all remember last year we were talking, we heard from many people about the problems of the loss, the lack, the shutdown of technical education in the high schools. And Representative Esquivel said, well, why can't we be doing a better job of partnering between the community college and the K-12? And out of that came a bill, House Bill 2732, out of this subcommittee, and it ultimately passed, and it created a task force to look into ways for better collaboration between our K-12 systems, community colleges, higher ed, our labor unions, industry, and then also nonprofits who are working with young people to give them career guidance and mentorship, leadership, and life. And so the task force was created. I am the House of Representatives representative on it. Senator Rosenbaum is the Senate representative on it. And there are a number of very good and I think very representative representatives for this task force. You should have the list, the roster. It includes the committee chair is Deborah Barnes, and she'll be introducing herself to you in a moment. She's a teacher in the K-12 system and a long-time advocate for technical education. We have someone from the Sheet Metal Workers Union, somebody from the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, Steve Sims from the from BOLI, the apprenticeship program. We have our vice chair is Carolyn Beckich, who's with Oregon Mentors, and she's a great resource for us. We have someone from the Department of Ed. We have somebody from community colleges. I don't know, am I leaving? There's somebody from the Northwest Construction College, I think, to represent private technical colleges. And it's a good group. We've had a couple of meetings staffed by Adrian Saxton from ODE. We will be having our next meeting actually this Thursday at the Sheet Metal Worker Apprenticeship Center. We're going to be looking at the kind of training they do, the kind of partnerships they're engaged in. They're involved in the ACE Academy, which we have talked about, and it is a very good group. One of the first things that I learned about all this, and I probably shouldn't have been surprised to know that we are not the first task force to have been set up on this subject. In fact, there have been several, and I think Deborah has been involved in all of them. One of the processes that began in 2005 resulted in a very extensive report that was done in 2008 looking at the situation in Oregon, but also looking at some model states that seem to be doing it right. By implication, I guess what I'm saying is Oregon is maybe not doing it right, but there are some others that are doing it better, and maybe Deborah can share some of that background with us, if you would. One of the things that is, I don't know if it's unique for Oregon, but Oregon is one of those states that does not have dedicated funding for career technical education. Other states do actually carve out pieces of the education allocation for this specific purpose. Oregon gets money from the federal government in the through the Carl Perkins program. Those are funds that go to K-12 and community college. Actually, those funds now are really, there's a big priority on using those to promote partnerships or pathways, and that's a very useful thing and something that we could turn to our advantage. But I can go into more detail. I just want to sort of lay out the framework for what we're doing. The task force is charged with coming back to the committee with a report in September, and so we'll be meeting throughout the summer and have a report for you, perhaps to deliver at our September meeting. And let me turn it over to Deborah. She can give us her sense of the process and her perspective as well.
Thank you.
Yes.
Chair Witt, this is my third task force. My name is Deborah Barnes, and I teach broadcasting and digital media at the Sabin-Schellenberg Center in the North Clackamas School District. Before I became a teacher, I was a broadcaster in the state of Oregon and, frankly, covered the legislature for 5 years. I'm also a member of the Milwaukee City Council, so I certainly understand legislative priorities and revenue shortfalls. But, frankly, this task force is just one of many where we've given the legislature reports. But sometimes, apparently, what we've learned, you didn't get the details. And I'm really hoping that this task force has the ability to pass along the full report to you so that you fully understand that out of all of the states we've looked at, 7 states in the last task force, Oregon was way behind. Washington and California, our neighbors, completely outspend and give up revenue for CTE. And the data shows that it works. Right now, 30% of our high school students do not graduate from high school. 30%. We continue to fund education, though, the way we did 50 years ago. Paper and pencil is no longer rigorous, relevant, and has no relationship to what the kids need or want to learn. In order for them to stay in school, they have to find something that is their passion. Over 3,000 students in North Clackamas attend our classes. We have 20 different programs. I was listening to the community college representative. We have a very nice auto mechanics program. We have a health services program. We have everything you can imagine, law enforcement, fire science. And the kids in our program succeed because they want to be there. Every day they walk into our programs and they're engaged. I don't have a textbook in my classroom because it isn't relevant, because my business doesn't have a textbook. But kids walk in, grab a piece of very expensive equipment, learn time management skills, how to meet deadlines, how to communicate, how to do teamwork, and they want to continue their education or an apprenticeship program or go straight into the work field. And every one of our programs is governed by an advisory panel. People made up of business and industry and union representatives, the AFTRA president is part of my panel. Steve Dunn, who is the anchor at Channel 2, is part of my advisory panel. They meet with us 4 times a year to make sure our curriculum is up to standard. They make sure that we have a voice when the district cuts. And right now, North Clackamas is cutting, and the biggest cut at Sabin-Schellenberg, where 6 of our teachers lost part of their FTE. But the problem with this is if we don't fund education that includes CTE in the future, we're going to miss the mark. We truly are. And I'm not going to read what I gave you, but I want you to see the last two pages. I printed out data straight from the Oregon Department of Education. Our kids do better in reading on assessment tests. Our kids do better in writing, in math. And 98% to 99% graduate from high school. This can show you, as, and the one thing we've learned from our business partners on this task force, they said over and over again already, why are we investing when kids are dropping out 30%, but we're not investing in CTE, where nearly 100% graduate from high school? It's not working, folks. We've got to change the way we think about teaching our kids. Because if we really want them to stay in school, it's got to be relevant. It's got to mean something to them, and it's got to hook them. And I would invite any of you, and I know that Representative Kenemer has been there, come out to Sabin-Schellenberg. See what real learning can do for kids, where I literally have to kick them out the door, or I don't get to go home at night, because they want to be there and finish that senior capstone project. They want to connect with kids that are thinking just like them so they can go on to college. The best success story is a kid who started in my program his junior year, ended up being the chief editor of the show Vegas on NBC. He came back and said, Barnes, I really want to thank you. Guess what? I got my own parking spot at NBC. And I said, you should be thanking me. It's a great experience, honest to God. It's incredible to watch. And this task force will have recommendations for you. I know times are tough, but if it means we have to reinvest our money in someplace that works, that's the right business plan. That's the right way to keep our kids in school. And I would urge you to think about this seriously. I'll take questions.
Thank you very much. Yes, Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for that information. That's very informative. But it also runs parallel with myself and Senator Klavansky are on the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps, and we work with alternative schools. Isn't it amazing how brick-and-mortar schools on a certain segment kind of lose track of these kids, yet when they get into a system that they like, that cares about them, I mean really cares about them, because that's the thing that comes out with alternative schools, how they flourish. And how well they do. They're incredibly intelligent kids, and yet they do not fit the, quote, mold in the brick-and-mortar school. And I think it's a tragedy, which we've discussed before, and I won't get into it because you guys have heard it many times, that less than 18% of all high school students that enter high school graduate out of college. So that means that we're leaving out 82% of the population. We need to change what we're doing, because obviously what we're doing, since our last grade grading came out nationally, we were 43rd in results. That's not real shiny. So we need to change what we're doing, reevaluate, and I agree with you. You need to fund it accordingly, because what we're doing today obviously may not be the best thing for the majority of our students.
And I would agree with that. North Clackamas does not get separate funding, but North Clackamas, the school board, made the decision over 35 years ago that this was important. It started out with really small classes, 15 kids, maybe 10 programs. We're up to over 20 programs, and next year I have 40 kids forecasted for my class, and they're doing senior capstone projects. So that means an awful lot of cameras and computers. And I write at least 5 grants a year. I'm lucky enough that I raise about $80,000 as a teacher. Why would our teaching force have to write grants in order to give kids what they deserve? And that's sad. But I'm lucky because I've been able to write grants. And I will tell you, as the only CTE teacher on this task force that's a high school teacher who just finished a day of school, they're going to do an award show this week where they're honoring each other. And that thrill I have as a teacher, I would never be a broadcaster again, knowing the feeling I have in that classroom, especially this week, watching the seniors graduate, having something to show for their education, and being proud of themselves. That makes it worthwhile. And there are teachers all over this state who feel the same way. I just hope someday we have the money to give every kid this opportunity.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, just if I can just... tack on one thing to what Representative Esquivel said. I'm glad that you mentioned the Youth Conservation Corps, because that's also something that we're talking about, is taking advantage of programs outside of the classroom, things like summer employment or programs geared actually towards middle school kids, to get them interested in technical education, that you know, the sense is that by the time they get to high school, for many of them, they've already tuned out. And so to have some kind of experience in the eighth grade or the summer between eighth and ninth grade, where they're able to apply their learning in a really, you know, an interesting and fun way, is really something that we should be promoting. And that's also the benefit of a program that really takes advantage of mentors, I think, to get kids hooked in. Again, the classroom is really critical, but outside the classroom is equally critical.
Representative Kennemer.
Thank you. I guess my comments, welcome, by the way.
Thank you.
My comments is more along the lines of testimonials, I guess. This weekend, I had the good misfortune to help my son finish up a remodel on his house. And it was interesting to go there, and one of his good buddies found his niche in building trades at Sabin Center. That's where he got started, and he was a kid who came from a dysfunctional family, spent a lot of hours at our house, and didn't know where he was going to go, and didn't have a clue about life, and has had meaningful employment and become a strong contributing member of society as a result of, I think, a lot of it was just skills. He needed a place to go. I mean, he didn't have any family support, so what was going to happen in his life? And the other's an intriguing one, too. Both my children were in that district, and they also attended Sabin Center at my wife and my insistence. And I think it's one of the reasons one has nearly a master's degree and the other has a doctorate. They saw some things they didn't particularly wish to do for the rest of their lives, as well as appreciated that there are a wide variety of things to do in this world. And I think it was... yet I still remember quite an interesting discussion with my younger son, who was very bright but not very motivated. And, you know, it was really interesting. He says, Dad, some of these kids can't do this stuff. And it was just disbelief at the differences in individual differences among people and the skills and lacks of skills and what some training could do. And I think it's made a real difference in their lives. So I think there are lots of ways this pays off.
Representative Kennemer, your remarks remind me of a statement that General Caldwell made before this subcommittee last session, and I think it bears remembering. And General Caldwell said that it's his opinion that we could cure about 85% of this state's problems if we just made sure that everyone who wanted a good job had a good job. So. Additional questions or comments for our panel? I had a couple here. Deborah, when you talked about missing the boat, and if we don't provide CTE, and I think you're going to have virtually unanimous agreement here from the subcommittee. At what level do you start? Do we start at the state level and work down? Do we start at the local level and work up? Do we run parallel tracks? Who's best situated to begin this process?
I'll be honest with you. The local authority is important, and a school district has to buy into it,
right.
But they can't buy into it if they don't have funds. The state, quite frankly, has to make priorities, just like the rest of us do, just like I have to do with the city. But you have to work off of data. And if I can continue to show lawmakers data that shows 98% of our kids graduate, they get higher test scores in reading, writing, and math, then you make the decision. Do you want to invest in what hasn't been working for the past several years, or do you want to use some of that money, even if it's just a pilot program, and invest in CTE specifically? Frankly, Senator Schrader tried that while he was a member of this body and made sure that Sabin-Schellenberg had specific funding We used it very well, and the test scores went up. I would like to see regional facilities all over this state, especially in rural Oregon, where you partner with the community colleges so that we can share resources. We're lucky we have a skill center. At one time, we were a regional facility where the legislature gave us funding every biennium, so kids from Oregon City and Westland and Canby and a bunch of other school districts could send their students to us so that we don't have to duplicate our efforts, have skill centers just like Washington State and California do. But the investment is capital construction to start with. You have to have equipment, and you can't give us hand-me-downs. Because if we want our kids to have the best education possible in CTE, it has to be state-of-the-art. Yes, we did have the investment in North Clackamas, but it's paid off. Beaverton, look at the statistics. It's paid off. Every school district that's found the money for CTE, it's paid off. Kids have done better. So my answer to you is, Department of Ed, I don't want to squeeze money out of an already squeezed budget. But you have to make a choice which your priorities are, CTE, even on a small scale to start with, or you stay with what you've got. And then you go and ask for more Carl Perkins money for Oregon. It's a drop in the bucket. It's like $6,000 for Sabin Schellenberg. That's not going to fund anything. So, you know, it's really up to you and the decisions you make with priorities. Mm-hmm.
Deborah, as someone who has been down this path before, can you give us the take-home messages from the previous task forces that have looked at this area?
They're all going to tell you the same thing in any report you look at. And I'm, you know, the one thing I learned when we were sitting, this is the best task force, by the way, because we have two lawmakers on it. It's a big difference because the message is going straight here to you. We didn't have that before, and somehow the communication got lost. This huge task force report that we spent months on apparently didn't get to all of you, and that is like, what? The message has to be the same thing that I've been preaching since Ron Dexter brought me here 15 years ago when he started the lobbying effort, and he gave it over to me as a teacher. It does make a difference when you invest money in CTE, beginning at the high school, if not middle school level. It keeps kids in school. It shows them what they can be passionate about. And we're not just talking the kids who are about to drop out. I've had the 4.0 students as well and everything in between. And watching that 4.0 student hook up with that nearly dropped out kid together, there's magic. Mm-hmm. There's so much incredible energy that happens when those kids work together. Because they're not from three different high schools like they are in my district, Putnam, Milwaukee, and Clackamas, Joint, Sabin, Schellenberg. They're a family. They literally believe in themselves as a family when they walk out that door and work together as a team. And aren't those the skills we want our kids to bring on to community college and apprenticeship programs and the real world? That's what we're missing, folks. We're not giving our kids a chance to do that. Come out to Sabin, Schellenberg. I'll give you a tour. You'll love it.
Thank you. Yeah. Representative Holby.
Yeah, I just had a real quick question along these lines of the drop of communication from your task force to the legislature. And I guess my question is directed to Representative Dimbro because, you know, as Chair Witt knows, I've sat on numerous committee meetings with him on this subject for the last few sessions, and Representative Esquivel as well. I guess the communication also doesn't seem like it gets from this committee over to the Education Committee and from this committee and the Education Committee to the Ways and Means Committee when the agencies are coming in to talk about their budgets. And it seems like our message gets lost in the process of the legislature as well when it comes to budgeting for these types of programs, and why we're not getting the buy-in from all the appropriate committees and the agencies when we've heard this time and time again, is this is just something that's absolutely essential for moving not just kids' lives but our industries, our economy forward as well. And I've been around here just, long enough to figure out that there are some communication problems, but we really need to figure out how to make that message from this committee over to the Education Committee and to the agencies and then on throughout the process to the Ways and Means process. And, maybe we need to have a plan on how to make that piece of it happen as well once we have the task force information before us. I don't know if you've come up with any grand scheme to make all that happen, but I'd certainly like to help you do
no,
that.
No, yes. I'd love to sit down and scheme with you about this. And I do think that's exactly what we have to do because it's, I think that Deborah's right. I think it really helps having lawmakers on the committee, on the task force, but we really have to think about what kind of trajectory we can be looking at for taking the recommendations and making them a reality. Obviously, we're in a tough financial situation, and we have to think about the impact of changes on the individual districts, but, I think that we can come up with some kind of master plan that can start making a difference in this next legislative session. And I think that it'll be very appropriate for the energy behind that to come from this committee, but the Education Committee, I agree, has to be right, has to be front and center as well. So we'll be presenting the report to the Education Committee as well as to this committee.
Representative Holley, it appears to me that it would make sense that when Representative Dembro's task force makes that report, that maybe we should consider a joint hearing, both of our committees, so that we get the same message, and that both committees hear it, hear the same things, and hopefully can make this a priority. And I sympathize too. I am concerned about that message translating or getting translated to Ways and Means, and I'm not exactly sure how we do that at this point, but with the very adept scheming that the two of you are going to undertake here, I'm sure that we'll find a way to make that happen.
Planning.
Yes, planning. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Mulick.
I sat on education in the 2007 session and saw how hard it was to deal with a relatively simple question, introducing civics education and personal finance education into the high school curriculum. I've got another curriculum issue that I'm interested in. We're talking about a pretty massive change to go back to. And one of the problems is nobody's given us a plan that says, and we may have failed enough, that says here's where we go, here's where we want to be 10 years from now, 15 years from now. I'm easy. And here's the plan to get there. Here's what we need to do this biennium, next biennium, and ongoing. And I agree with you. We've talked about it for years. Everybody believes we should have more vocational education in the high schools. That's not the issue. The issue is how do we do it? Right. And I was wondering the extent to which you all are really working on a sort of a coherent vision with an operational model on how we get toward that vision. And it's not going to be next year or the year after. It's going to be somewhere downstream. But it would be very useful if we could have a plan that would move us where we need to go in this. Because it is we also tell the schools they have to have this much physical education and they have to make room for PE. We're telling the schools they have to increase their math and their English studies. We have all these ideas, and the fact is every one of them is right. But how do we get there is the big problem, I think.
I do want to add, a lot of folks don't know that we're doing a lot of credit for proficiency at the CTE level. So students in my program can get language arts and U.S. history credit. I am not the teacher of record, but I work with
someone who is licensed to teach history and who's licensed to teach language arts, but I teach the curriculum, and then they'll come in and go over a notebook and ask the students questions. So you can get math and science and reading and history in a CTE program under credit for proficiency. If it's a requirement with the state, it's kind of a Fred Meyer of education. It's your one-stop shopping center for kids to get all of those skills they need to understand the importance of education, and they can get the core subjects. I'm not saying replace core subjects, but we can be that avenue for those kids who can't sit in a classroom for an hour or an hour and a half, who might drop out if that's their only option. But if they can get it in our class while they're learning that CTE class, it's a win-win for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let me just follow up on that. There are a number of really interesting initiatives happening around the state, around, you know, as Deborah mentioned, proficiency-based education and students learning math skills through technical subjects. And, you know, there are a number of kids who are doing much better in math through that avenue than through the traditional way. There are a number of different initiatives, but, and this goes back to Rep. Greenlick's point, it's kind of a scattershot approach at this point, and we need a way to bring them together in a systematic, planful kind of manner. And, you know, that is something, you know, I think the task force is going to be struggling with. That's a big job. You know, will we have the master plan down in time for September? Probably not. But hopefully we can start moving things in a certain direction so that at least the high-level recommendations that the previous reports have come up with can, you know, be adopted, and then we can think about, okay, so how do we implement these goals of regional centers and proficiency-based mathematics education, et cetera.
If I could just give an example of that, I mean, that's really true. My son-in-law teaches at Franklin. There's a course there in medical terminology for people, and it's a really interesting course for some of the kids. It turns out the kids that take medical terminology do better in English results and their reading results than any other kids, which sort of makes the English department mad, but that's a different question. But, yeah, so is that the answer? Is the answer to convert education? I mean, you want to talk to Ways and Means. What are we going to ask Ways and Means for?
Well, I understand your question only too well, Representative Greenlick, and I think that that's a challenge that does confront us, and I think that is a fundamental part of that planning that Representative Esquivel was referring to. And Representative Dembro here has, underscored a concern that I've had for a very long time. In answer to your earlier question, you know, who... I think as good a place to start is some joint meetings, as Representative Holby has suggested, between this subcommittee and the Education Committee. With that said, I am mindful of what some of our previous panelists have said, that it's absolutely critical that we have industry involved in this and leading the way. I also think that short of a central planning on the part of the legislature, that we have a very significant role, or could have a significant role, because I have seen time and time again, our subcommittee has heard from business, we've heard from labor, we've heard from various elements of nonprofits and government, that folks are willing to they're willing to do their part. They need someone that provides that leadership, and that's why my earlier question, who is everyone's Frank Foti, and maybe part of our role is making it possible to have a coordinator We heard President Hamilton talk about he has two folks full-time who have learned how to hustle and go out and to create partnerships, and maybe the legislature has a role in making it possible for someone to be out there creating these partnerships, sustaining these partnerships, nurturing them, and expanding them. So that's just kind of the evolutionary part of my thought process, but we've heard a lot of good information here today, and with that, Representative Esquivel has been extremely patient. I have, after Representative Esquivel, I have Representatives Huffman and Holby on deck. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. And to me, we have some basis and a base of strength, some of our communities, and that is with our community colleges. Example I have in Southern Oregon, the Table Rock campus of Rogue Community College, which has all of the above. But yet we don't seem to be able to get the school districts to work in conjunction with the community college to use the facilities, which is beyond my belief. Mm-hmm. But having said that, Representative Dembrough, we may have to talk about some way to maybe force feed some people.
I appreciate that, Representative. One of the things that the task force is charged with doing is doing an assessment of where partnerships are happening and where they're not happening. And, you know, in the material that you have access to that was distributed electronically or in hard copy, there's a preliminary list of some of those. I have heard that there is some partnership happening between that college and the school district. I didn't see it on that list, so I don't know. But that is an important part of this process, I think, is to do an inventory of, you know, what's out there, what's working, and where we have real lacks.
Representative Huffman, Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Representative Esquivel and Dembrough kind of danced right up to the door of what I was going to say. We have heard frequently, as Chair Witt said, from industry that CTE is a priority for industry. And Chair Witt also said it would probably be unanimous on this committee, the support for CTE, because we've studied the issue nearly to death. It probably won't be to death until September when we get yet another report reinforcing what most people that we communicate with believe is a priority for the future health of our state, for the workforce, for our kids. A couple of things that we deal with are we believe in Oregon that local control of our schools is very important. So a top-down approach is going to be difficult in mandating a CTE curriculum. We need to have that local buy-in. Now, I don't know what the task force is going to be doing to see what kind of broad-based desire among roughly 200 school districts, what the desire is, and or do our local K-12s have the same buy-in? Do they see the same need as industry seems to see the need? And I agree, it's Representative Greenlick and Esquivel mentioned, you know, it's kind of like we are all talking about the need, but we keep running into this brick wall. And not to cast aspersions on anybody in the room, but as I was sitting here thinking about it, the folks that I seem to consistently miss at the table are the associations, the various associations, and I'm not going to say Oregon Education Association, the various associations.
I'm on the board.
They don't seem to ever be at the table when it comes to the talk about the need for CTE. And I hadn't really, you know, as you guys were talking, I was just sitting there kind of thinking this through. And those are the ones that seem to be absent most of the time. I mean, we have these same discussions ad nauseum on OWIB, the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, and Green Jobs Council, and every other place that I sit. But the representatives from K-12 are typically, I mean, community colleges, CCWD are always there, but it's the K-12 part that seems to be the missing key component. That reach into the local school boards, the local school districts, the local businesses to hook them up with this desire. Am I wrong?
And that's understandable because, like, I can tell you North Clackamas spends a great deal of money. There is no outside money. The districts made the decision. The traditional way of teaching is important. But in addition to that, they want to invest in CTE. So it's a good marriage, and it's worked for years. But for those smaller school districts, they don't have the option based on all of the things that the state has mandated that they have their high school kids do. We're lucky. It's been that way for a long time, and I know from being a member of OACTE at one point, there are teachers all over this state who would love to have their CTE programs back, but they've been cut because there's no money for CTE. And you bring up the union. I don't speak for OEA in this position today, but I am a board member of the OEA, and everyone on that board knows I am a CTE rep. And Lindsay, who's in the back of the room, knows full well what I'm doing today, as does the rest of the board. I believe in CTE so much that I would never work anywhere else than Sabin-Schellenberg. And I gave up a career that gave me, frankly, a lot more money than I'm making today, but the rewards are endless for me as a teacher. So I will be down here every session, as I have been. Well, Representative Witt has probably seen me way too often than he's wanted to see me, but I will come anywhere close to begging because I know this works. I know what it does for kids. And this task force is, again, trying to say in a very subtle way, you need to invest in something that is showing you the data that the kids stay in school and they go on to a community college or the workforce program or apprenticeship or out to a job. Isn't that what we want? Isn't that the bottom line for this state now? The kids win and the businesses win.
Just please follow up closure. And because Lindsay was sitting in the back of the room, I said I wasn't casting aspersions. It occurred to me that there is a group that seems to always be absent from the table. And if the desire is there at every level, you know, usually you can find a way to make something happen, whether it's money or whatever. If it starts with desire, that spark.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah. If I could just say, you know, I think that there is a lot of desire in the school districts for career technical education. And people are just looking for help in getting to that point. It's not that there's resistance to it, right? It's not as if the state is going to be imposing that vision on them. I think they would like to see that happen. They see the potential partnerships with the labor unions and with industry and, you know, all sorts of partners, things which could potentially leverage whatever financial resources are put into them. But they're just trying to keep the operation going. You know how that is. And so, you know, I think that what we can really provide to begin with is a vision of what's possible.
And I suspect that if we were here discussing potential cuts to industrial arts programs, we might have a room full of shop teachers here, but it's gotten so bad they don't exist. They're not here left. Because they don't exist. Is that, I mean,
there's three of them left.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Esquivel. And so, I mean, we have de-evolved to the point where we're talking about resurrecting something that we lost.
Mm-hmm.
what, quarter century ago? I don't know. I mean, a very long time ago, which is terribly unfortunate, and a commentary on the point to which we've allowed ourselves to get to. Deborah, don't ever think for once that we see you too often. And I think, again, you would find a unanimous opinion on this subcommittee that... we look forward to the day where people like yourself don't have to be applying for grants to do something that should be part of our everyday educational curricula in this state. So thank you for everything that you do. Representative Holvey.
It's been so long ago, I forgot what I was going to talk about. But certainly I think, you know, everybody needs money. And, you know, these programs are really important. And we need to figure out how to prioritize to make sure we can reinvigorate this somehow. And certainly there's, you know, private partners and all that. But, you know, a dedicated funding source certainly sounds interesting. You know, if we could get people to agree on some way to fund some of this stuff, it seems like it would get us a long ways down the road. But other than, because it seems like we're up against trying to take some funding away from another program, and then we find out, oh, that's a required mandate from somewhere that we have to do, and you know, and then we're looking in every pocket trying to find some dollars to put into these types of programs, and that's what gets frustrating, and that's probably what the Ways and Means goes. We can't find the pockets, and I don't know that to be sure, but certainly we should prioritize and take this message and keep running that message out there. And I, the thing I was going to ask, Mr. Chair, was that somehow we don't miss the legislature gets the report from the task force, and it'd be interesting to see the past reports that we should have gotten as well, Mr. Chair. I would, you know, so that we can put all this stuff together and help fashion some sort of message going forward. And thank you.
Yes, and just in response to that last point, I think you may have received, or if not, you will, at least the executive summary of the 2008 report, which really is very useful.
Thank you very, very much. Anything further from the subcommittee? I want to thank you both very, very much. And Representative Dembrough, I'm going to ask that you and Teresa kind of keep me up to speed. And when you're ready to give us another updated report, we're going to look at inviting the Education Committee to join us for that report. I think that's critically important. Thank you.
Yes, I'm sure we can get Representative Huffman to come to that.
At least two of us.
Great. Thank you so very, very much. I certainly appreciate it. There have been a lot of folks that you've spent 2.5 hours here in the audience who sat very patiently, and you must have been interested because I don't see you sleeping. And I just want to offer an opportunity if any of you at this point wanted to respond to anything that you've heard today, just brief comments. Anyone?
Here comes a member of the choir.
Never give me a second. Mike Sullivan from the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers. To Representative Esquivel's point of 18% are college graduate. I always heard 25, so it's gotten worse. But what's even more unflattering about that is over 50% of the people that get their college education never go in the field of their own majors. So we're educating people to think, but not where they've learned to apply it. So we now have a workforce that's educated, but really doesn't really produce anything tangible, as to say, this program we just talked about. So it's a real problem within our society. We have a lot of people that are educated, but really don't have a place to work. And from a union standpoint, I can tell you that puts a lot of human resources directors in positions where they go on witch hunts when they should really be worried about developing their workforce. Just my personal opinion.
It's that whole notion of the importance of applied education, applied learning.
Mm-hmm. And if I could just follow up on that, Mr. Chair, you know, we have this tendency, we talk about silos, but, you know, there's also related to that is the blame game. You know, once you are in your silo, then you can criticize the other silo. And, you know, I think a lot of people in industry blame our educational system for, you know, issues related to workers, without being willing to step up to the plate and really help to find solutions. We have people in higher education who blame the community colleges or the high schools. People in the high schools who blame the middle schools. Middle schools, you know, everybody is pointing the fingers at someone else where, you know, really this issue is one that should be bringing people together and trying to find a common solution. And yes, it, to some extent it'll take investment and some pain, but the rewards will be worth it.
If I can, please share with Representative Dembro, I'm not trying to blame anyone. It's just the way our society in America works. In Europe, they have a much more clear approach to education. Not that I'd necessarily follow that to the T, but there has to be more emphasis on our technical skills, because I've heard an electrician at a labor council say that they're putting up lines now. They don't really have educated electricians to do that anymore because these people have phased out. And that's the other problem of training, is if you don't have the old masters, if you will, to teach the younger people, you've lost the whole art of it.
And we heard earlier the shipyard experience, where for welders and shipyard repair, people are not getting exposed until they're adults. And your reference to the European model, folks are exposed certainly by high school, probably junior high school. At least in junior high school, they're thinking about it. And some options and alternatives are available to them, and they're it's part of their career decision-making process, which, you know, once again, we've heard repeatedly before this subcommittee, people bang around for how many years before after high school graduation, before they're actually in a career. And that, excuse me, banging around period, I think my own editorial is largely a loss. It's a loss to the individual. It's a loss to our state's workforce. It's a loss to our employers. It's a loss to this state's productivity. It's a loss to our ability to compete in the global marketplace. We have to change it.
Yes, Chair Witt, and no disrespect intended, but I figure if it was good enough for Jesus Christ to be a carpenter, then it's okay to work with your hands.
Okay. Thank you very much. Please, have one other member of the audience who'd like
maybe
to make
two, maybe two.
Oh, and Bill.
Maybe
Bill,
two.
Bill,
come on
Bill
up if
John.
You want.
For the record, John Rakowitz.
The average age of a graduate of an electrical apprenticeship now is 25 years old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the point you were making.
Yeah.
Way too old.
Yes.
I had not planned on testifying. For the record, John Rakowitz with AGC, Associated General Contractors, but it's I just wanted to remind the committee that there's actually a large coalition that was put together and came and testified, I believe, to this subcommittee in 2009. It was pretty extraordinary. Mm-hmm. It was Farm Bureau, contractors, yes. Association of Oregon Industries. It just kept going through a range of industries. And on the other hand, you had the trades, public sector unions. You had, it was the only time I ever got up with that group and that company, and we were all a little uncomfortable. We weren't sure.
And you survived.
We had you on film.
You survived.
But I don't mean to make light of it at all. We make, you know, AGC is one of the founding supporters and funding, continue to fund, programs like ACE, because it's critical to our industry. In our industry, the average age now is about 28 years of age when they come online. Well, that's at least 10 years that what have they been doing? They're working minimum wage jobs. They're bouncing around from this to that. I mean, that's 10 years lost in anybody's life. So we're here and ready to participate in this. And I kind of come at this from a business point of view. You know, there's a way to challenge some of this too. You've got your operational cost. I mean, you got to get down to the business plan part of it, and you've got your equipment, et cetera, cost. I have a lot of workforce history in my background. I've done a lot of different things, and so I've done a lot of this for different industries. And you can certainly try on the equipment cost. If you break the two parts out, then maybe you start getting down to that business plan and start looking at how you can actually fund some of these regional centers. I live a mile from Sabin, shall always mess it up, about a mile down the road, and I'm well aware of what they do. I've been supportive of them from other business association positions. So there's certainly a lot of willingness here on the part of a broad group, a broad coalition, and I know that I'm not speaking on his behalf, but I know that Labor Commissioner Avakian has not given up on this issue whatsoever. We've continued to have talks. So, you know, it's one of those beautiful areas where the individual and the business and the state and everybody benefits. So we're here to participate, and I think you'd have a broad coalition that you could pull back together again. Might make us a little nervous, but we get used to sit around the same table and actually do something that we can all agree to. It's nice to testify when you can actually be positive and not try to oppose something or whatever. So,
well,
for what it's worth.
In speaking to that directly, John, and thank you for coming forward here. I mentioned earlier that we've had this subcommittee has had a broad, diverse group of folks that said, I'm willing to help out, but I guess what's lacking is that leadership. And I don't know if you've had leadership is maybe the wrong term here, but the infrastructure that would help coordinate everybody else is willing to help. I'm willing to help. Just tell me what I'm supposed to do. That may or may not have merit, but I guess my question to you is, have you had an opportunity to think about what the legislature's role, what our role is here? And I'm going back to Representative Greenlick's earlier question.
Well, at risk of getting way out here, I think the regional centers are a really appropriate idea.
Okay.
Number
Good.
One.
Thank you.
And number two, I think you break the cost down. Why should the state necessarily come up with the equipment? I think you could do some challenges of industry out there and try to come up with that equipment. I've seen that happen before. The first time I dealt with this issue was in 1988 when I was a part of the Children's Agenda under the Neil Goldschmidt administration, and there was Business Education Compact, and they were establishing these partnerships. And I watched almost all of those fade away in that period of time. Somebody like a Vicki Fleming, and engage somebody like that. She's been in the paper Sunday and Saturday, I think, on this issue. Former deputy superintendent at Department of Education, superintendent of Redmond Schools until just recently, building a whole school around vocational, so-called vocational tech career, whatever you want to call it. I think there are parties out there that know more than I do, but those are the kind of people. I think you start with the regional model, and I think you also do a business pro forma. You know, talk about what the costs look like for one. If you don't have you might not have the master plan that Representative Greenwood talked about, but at least come up with the pro forma, or go out and with the woman who just testified and the others that exist perhaps in Southern Oregon, you pick out two or three models. They're all probably going to look like they're funded a little different, and use them, and then fund a couple, two or three of them. You will then, over the course, we know all how it works. I was just in a committee hearing down the just on the other side in the Senate, and the entire room was filled with labor organizations, trade associations on the private side having to do with the U of O arena. Well, when you fund enough of this, you'll fill up this room.
Yeah.
Just like anything else. And so I think the regional model is an effective model. It and you pick two or three that are different. One works in an urban area, one works in a more rural area. Pick a Southern Oregon, pick a Central. Find where you've got the basics, where you have the support. Break down a business plan. What do the costs look like? What are we really talking about? Because we always talk in these grand terms. Well, let's just talk what the investment would look like. And if you bring it down to something like that, I wonder what would happen when that's put in front of this committee, Education Committee Ways and Means. You're talking about something a little more comprehensible, I think. That's just me talking off the top of my head.
Thank you so very much. Representative Demereaux.
Yeah, just to respond to that. I mean, obviously, John has a spy in the in our committee. What he's saying is really the kind of thing that we're looking at precisely. And you know, I think the idea of a pilot programs, pilot regional centers, makes a lot of sense for the short term. But you know, while at the same time coming up with a long term vision of where we might go.
Sure. Sure, I'm just Chair Witt, Representative Demmer. I didn't know you had a committee. I've taken about four passes. It's like tours in the military or something through workforce development, and it's you've been in a long time. Anybody has. It's really tough to make this work. And my children's mother went through the German education system. By the time she was in the seventh grade, she already made a decision.
Yeah.
And then she changed her decision later and went through a university, but she first went through a skilled trade. That's the way they're set up. They're set up in an old apprenticeship system and a university system, and they have both in place. We just don't have that in this country. So I think the pilots, though, give you the foundation to get something moving, and then the broader thing can be supported by the pilots, because I always think we go for the grand, and then it's so big, how's it affordable, it's too complex, too much of a risk. So that's why I come up with a sort of pilot program, for what it's worth.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that, John, and I know last session we did have a readiness certificate bill that was going to try to do something with the pilot that we had in place with the ACE Academy, where you did have the private resources at the table, and
that's what we're trying to do.
Everybody stepping forward, and unfortunately, that fell apart someplace between us passing that out of this committee and it going through to the final or getting it to the governor's desk, I guess, to implement it. And so that's frustrating, because I think that model was laid out for us, that business model was laid out for us, and everything was there. And I think we all have to just dust that off, and we got one option right there.
Representative Witt, at risk of making this less feel good, what's currently going on at ACE right now, and I'm working with Director of Apprenticeship Program Steve Sims on this and others, we're trying to keep that program alive. And the underlying problem right now is they're not getting the referrals they were getting. There's not less interest. We all know what's behind that. They're simply not getting the referrals from the high school. So ultimately, I think Representative Dimroe and his task forces, and I think Representative Huffman and various other today pointed to what the issue is. There has to be a willingness between the various silos to send the kids where they have the real interest.
Yeah.
And right now, ACE is struggling because of that issue, primarily.
Mr. Chair, can I say that? You say we all know what the problem is. What's the problem?
Well, it's average daily attendance. It's getting paid per head. I mean, I'm sure I'm going to be in big trouble as soon as I walk out of this room, but that's part of the problem, isn't it? I mean, if I was sitting in a school trying to hold the budget together, I'm going to struggle with that. All I know is the referrals are not as numerous as they were. So I'm inferring that I know what that is. I just know that they're not. So by the time we get through 2011, we hope to keep ACE alive, but will we? So, you know, it takes multiple partners here, and we've launched it. We tried to support it heavily financially for an association our size. We invested huge amounts of money, and it's not just for us. It's architects, engineers, it's construction, it's the trades, it's any and everything that construction industry a whole needs. So I think you see industry trying to step up, and I don't mean to get into a blame game. I just noticed that right now the referrals are not coming. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe there are other issues, but when you're in a limited resource environment, you know, referring out to another place, I think that's a difficult proposition for anybody. I don't care what industry or sector you're in. So I'll probably get jumped on for this. I shouldn't have gone out there that far.
No, but John, we appreciate that. And frankly, Representative Holby and I have had some discussions that we probably needed an update on that situation, because, quite frankly, I mean, this subcommittee invested itself in terms of our interest and our promotion of that model fairly heavily the last go around, and
Representative Holvey, we're going to run her up the flagpole again here one way or another. So,
and let me add just one thing for the record. You know, I only know what I know from our board meetings or talking to Dick O'Connor. If you really want to know what's going on with that program, you got to get Dick O'Connor in here. And by the way, I think he's going to be retiring. So we're looking at a change in leadership there as well. So any interest you have in that, we have a deep investment. We're happy to participate in any way, but also happy to participate in the other efforts because, like I said, we you know, today in workforce, Senate Workforce and Commerce Committee, the WorkSource economist said this. He was going through, and they're always very careful, and he got to construction. He says, well, it's simple. They've just been savaged and brutalized. That's a quote. We're 4 out of every 10 construction workers sitting on the bench right now. So, but we also know, as many members of this committee know, we're looking at a retirement situation mm-hmm. and a baby boom cliff that's coming at us. So even if we can start to recover and never get back to the kind of employment we had 2.5 years ago, you know, the kinds of numbers, we're still going to need replacement workers. So, you know, these are really good jobs. They pay $50,000 a year on average. They're higher than the average annual wage. So there's a lot of young people that could come in and do that replacement work, and I'm, at least two people here, I know I'm talking to the choir here, but so that's why we're invested. It's in our interest, you know, we're trying to make the investments and do whatever. But if you really want to know about ACE, obviously Dick O'Connor's the expert. So,
thank you very much. Representative Dumbrough.
No, I just wanted to say that the task force meeting this week at the Sheet Metal Workers Center, mm-hmm. but then our next one's going to be at the ACE Academy, and Steve Sims is on the task force as well, so
that's good.
Yeah.
John, thank you so much. It is good to hear that industry supports that regional model.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Bill.
Chair Witt, committee, Bill Pudding, Carpenters and Industrial Council. First, I want to thank this committee. You've listened and you've reacted. It took us 25 years to get where we're at today as far as our education, health, industrial work sector, you name it. But it took us 25 years to get there. We all know something has to change. And the remark was made we might have to force feed a few folks. Well, I think we're going to have to. Just kind of off the record, the two candidates for governor coming up. Both of them are stressing that K-12 schools is going to change. Status quo is not going to be the same. Now, whether that's a campaign promise or what, I don't know, but everybody knows we have a problem. People say, well, what about the finding jobs for the kids that are graduating? And I say, well, what about the 30-40% of the kids that never went past the 10th grade, the 9th grade? Where are they at today? We're paying for it. We either pay now and educate our kids. We have an educated workforce. The work will come. The industry will come. Industry will stay here. But if today's a good start, we picked a bad time to do it. Where this money's going to come from, I have no idea. We should try the Bill Gates Foundation. If we can build a $200 million basketball coliseum, if we can help finance a $200 million basketball coliseum, surely we can finance educating our kids. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bill. Welcome, sir.
Well, thank you, Chairman Witt. My name is Clifford Walker, and I want to thank each of you for sharing your challenges with Spectator in the back. I don't envy your task. But being given this opportunity to speak, I am the chairman of the Oregon Commission on Black Affairs, so that's why I'm here. And I care to represent that proverbial elephant in the room. When they were talking about the workforce and the people they were training. My question was, I wonder how many, I know they had, what, five women? I wonder if anybody was black, you know, because we have a problem too. We seem to be overrepresented in Oregon prisons, but that's about the only place we're getting more than our fair share of attention. The challenge of the Oregon Commission on Black Affairs is to be a part of government, learn how government works, and encourage people to participate. And I guess right now, with the changes even in Oregon state government, there's a vacuum for people of African American ancestry to be present. So I want to thank you for inviting me to the table. I am that proverbial elephant in the room. Don't forget us, please. One of our challenges is just to exist in Oregon government at any level, elected, commission level, or anything. So when that budget piece comes by, if any of you can support keeping blacks involved in Oregon government, because we share the problem, but it just seems to be magnified. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, Mr. Walker, I want to thank you very much for your time. You've spent a good long time in the back of the room here today.
Well, there's a reason. I'm going to buttonhole one of you.
Okay.
And I think that person knows who I am, because I need a coach in government. And I'm going to seek out one of you who knows me that may continue to help.
And I want to thank you for taking your valuable time to be here in the advocacy role that you are in. And I think it's a tribute to the Black Affairs Council that you had spent this amount of time for a very brief comment at the end of our agenda. We appreciate that immensely. And I just want to share with you, I know that there are a number of apprenticeship programs that have sought to increase their minority participation, and oftentimes without lack of success. And I think there may be a significant opportunity here for your council and for some of the apprenticeships in this state to work together to improve opportunities for the entire workforce here in the state of Oregon.
Well, I'm excited, and again, I think what motivated me to come before you was because I saw how you were challenged, and I really appreciate your work. I mean, I didn't know how challenging an hour or two could be, but good luck, and if there's anything I can do to help, I will. Thank you so much.
Well, back at you, sir. Thank you very much. Any additional questions or comments from the subcommittee? Gentlemen, thank you so very, very much. Certainly appreciate it.
Thank you.
And with that, we are adjourned.